Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Eastern Bank. Eastern Bank is committed to helping people and businesses prosper, investing over $240 million in local charities since 1994. Eastern Bank. Join us for good. EasternBank.com. Member FDIC. And Newbury Court, a full-service retirement community in Concord, Massachusetts. Newbury Court is committed to creating active, independent lifestyles for persons 62 and over. More at NewburyCourt.org.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, President Biden used his first address to Congress to argue for broad expansion of government services, universal preschool, tuition-free community college, expanded health care, much of it funded by asking the wealthiest to pitch in through higher taxes. He spoke in the same room that was stormed by insurrections, hoping to prevent his presidency just 4 months ago. NBC political director Chuck Todd joins us. Then we'll get your thoughts on both the president's speech and the GOP response.
More than a year after Ahmaud Arbery was killed while out for a jog, the three men accused of his murder have been indicted on hate crime and attempted kidnapping charges. The men who chased Arbery down with a truck and shot him claimed they were performing a citizen's arrest. Andrea Cabral would join us to offer her legal analysis on the case, what the federal charges mean, and more. All that ahead. Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Bradley, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Marjorie. So in 1996, during the State of the Union address, Bill Clinton declared the era of big government was over. Last night, President Biden said the big government is back. Did Biden do enough to sell Americans on his belief that government is the solution? Was there anything in Biden's address that could convince some Republicans in Congress to hop on his big government bandwagon? Joining us online to talk about this and other political headlines is Chuck Todd. Chuck is the moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston. That's Channel 10 on most providers. Also the host of Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC and the political director for NBC News. Good morning, Chuck Todd.
Well, hi there, guys.
Hi.
Hello, Chuck Todd. Great to talk to you. So, Chuck, none other than Fox News' Chris Wallace said last night that most Americans are going to like President Biden's speech last week. It's going to be very popular, he said, because they're going to get a lot of good stuff, child care, community health centers, et cetera, but they're not going to have to pay for it unless they make over $400,000 a year. So is he right?
This is, you know, it, sometimes politics is a simple game if you play it smartly, which is, you know, push popular stuff. You know, don't push unpopular stuff. That's the bottom line. If you are pushing popular stuff, you're better chance than not of succeeding in American politics. And that's where I think that right now, why I think this, you have a, first of all, the country wants more government involvement. You know, we've asked this question. We had our new NBC News poll this week. And, you know, should government be, you know, basically be more involved in solving the nation's problems, or should they get out of the way? And it's a question we've been tracking for 30 years. And it vacillates. Throughout most of the Obama years, people thought, no, we wanted less government. Starting with the Trump years, because Trump was advocating for more government involvement in his own way, and you still had movement on the deck, we've had basically a widening gap by double digits. So over 55% want more government involvement. It showed up again now. So this is, you have an electorate that wants government. And I do think, you know, I really worry about our current political media environment, because I look at my entire lifetime. I have lived under what I would call a political philosophy in this country that said, whoa, we've got a, you know, government was too involved in our lives in the first, you know, 70 years of sitting from the 1930 to 1980. Right. And we made this move from 1980 to Bill. You know, I always said you knew Ronald Reagan won the argument when Bill Clinton said the era of big government was over. Right. So here we are. But we've not, you know, there's not a single political reporter alive that remembers when the public was very open to more activist government, because we haven't seen it really since wage and price controls of Richard Nixon, when you had big government Republicans and big government Democrats. It was a regular thing. You invest, you know, Eisenhower was a big government Republican. What do you think the Interstate Highway System is?
Right.
A pretty big infrastructure project last time I checked, you know. So was Nixon, was a big government. In many ways, so was Ford. right? That was Reagan. That's why Reagan challenged him in a primary. So, you know, I do wonder if our political intelligentsia is prepared. Let me put it another way. I think Biden is a lot closer to where the country is than Washington is.
Well, you know, some of us were alive, actually.
Unfortunately.
And I'm one of them.
Well.
And I do remember a time, and I've said this a million times, where you could live in a reasonably nice town with a reasonably good school district, and your dad could work a job and support the whole family, and you could take a two-week vacation on Cape Cod. You know, that was the 60s and 70s. And I think it was significant that Biden said last night, trickle-down economics hasn't worked. And part of it, I think, is the realization that, no, it's been a scam. I mean...
Yeah, it didn't work. I mean, right, we passed all these. We said, you know, if you just cut taxes for the wealthy, you know, you're just going to unlock prosperity. Yeah, you unlocked prosperity for the 1%.
Right.
They've been amazing. They've prospered a lot. But it didn't, you know, hey, look, did some people use that money and invest and grow businesses? Of course. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. There are plenty of people who said, yeah, I'm going to take my wealth and keep investing it. But that's not what a lot of people did, you know, and we certainly didn't get enough of them. And you do need government incentives sometimes to, let's say, persuade people, persuade business. And no, this is how you got to pay these taxes. You got to invest in here, you know. So I do think that this is an argument that, and I think Biden's trying to say, hey, you lost. Supply side economics has turned out not to work. Keynesian John Maynard Keynes is still winning.
Well, I mean, the one thing that's obviously beyond dispute is it was soothing because it obviously soothed Ted Cruz to sleep. I mean, that is a given. And he looked great with his eyes closed, I would argue. But so, you know, one of the things I hate before speeches like this and after speeches, Chuck Todd, is all the analysts say he wasn't speaking to the people in the room. He was speaking over their heads to the American people, sort of the tiredest line in history, even if it's true. So assuming that you and Marjorie are right and he's giving the American people what they want, is there going to be enough of an uprising in any of the states that are Republican senators or that have Joe Manchin, any of those states convincing enough from the bottom up that a Republican or a Manchin says, I'm in?
Here's what I think here's what I feel like you're starting to see is I do think you're going to see there's a whole bunch of Republicans have made it clear to leadership that they want in on some of these infrastructure bills. The thing is, we sort of you could hear it in, you know, some of the off the records that the Republican leadership did with our teams and some of the off the records we did and all this stuff. And over the last couple of days, you get a sense that individual Republicans are like, hey, we know this money's going out the door, regardless of whether we're on board, we want in. Now, they don't want in on all of it, okay? They don't want in on the tax hikes. They don't want in on what the Democrats are calling human infrastructure, you know, that half of the bill. But I do think you're going to see, like, a waterworks bill that has bipartisan support. Maybe, you know, a separate broadband bill that – where they take pieces of it, and then come September, October, whatever didn't get passed in a bipartisan way gets all put into, you know, do I think the first of all, I also think the tax hikes are going to get minimized. Democratic senators are already floating the idea. Well, what's wrong with deficit spending? Yeah. And you know what? I think there is, you want to know the biggest disconnect between Washington and the American and the rest of the country, deficit spending. You know who doesn't give a rat's patootie about deficit spending? The American people.
Yeah.
you know, because if they did, a lot of people would have been thrown out of office a million times. You know, it didn't punish the Republicans that they passed their tax cut, you know, on the back of the national debt. And it ain't going to punish the Democrats if they pass their plan on that. And you know what? But you know what John Tester doesn't want to do? Because it's Tester, Coons. You know what they don't want to do? Vote for too many tax increases. Mm. They'll vote for some. They'll vote for that corporate tax rate up to, say, 25%. They don't want to do all the capital gains stuff, especially a guy like Tester. Capital gains, that's those rancher families. They hate that. And in month, you know, weirdly enough, that's a constituency that the Tester has to be mindful of. So I have a feeling that you will see some sort of some bipartisanship on the easiest low hanging fruit in physical infrastructure stuff. And then whatever's left. And I think Republicans are going to gamble that whatever's left is maybe too unpopular for Manchin to get on board. And that, to me, is going to be the question. How much, you know, what is Manchin willing to do with Democrats only?
So can we go to a little higher hanging fruit for a second?
Okay.
And one of the things I thought sort of ironic, if that's the right word, is the Republican response comes from a guy who says, Scott, obviously, from South Carolina, that there's no bipartisanship. This guy, Biden, talked bipartisanship. In fact, he's made us grow further apart. At the same time, that reports are that he's the one who's negotiating a deal on the George Floyd Policing Act. And from what I read, admittedly, quite a distance from where you are, they're getting somewhere. Are they? I think we asked you this last week, but that was before Scott spoke last night. Is there going to be a deal here?
You know, it's interesting. If there's not, we're never going to get a deal. Like, I do think it's really, really, really close. I mean, I do think they want to get to yes. I really do. But I will tell you, I was surprised at how partisan Scott's speech was last night.
Yeah, me too.
And Scott's already been on Fox News this morning. Literally, as I was reading I got the speech text about, you know, we were in the commercial break before he was to come on. And so I'm reading through it. I'm like, oh, this is a 2024 primary stump speech. Mm. Like, you suddenly realize, oh, he decided to speak to Hannity's audience, not Tucker's audience. I think there's a difference, right? Tucker is like totally unhinged and off, right? Hannity
sure
is more of your, you know, a little more conventionally unhinged,
God.
You know, predictably unhinged. But it was weird to me because that's not, you know, Tim Scott likes to portray himself a little more, you know, he doesn't antagonize MAGA world, but he likes to be above it. And he seemed to want to appeal to them in a little bit. So I will tell you this, it made me, the cynical part of my brain said, well, maybe police reform doesn't happen. Maybe Lucy's going to pull the football once again, because that sounded like, he's already accusing the Democrats of wanting the issue. And it's like, where do the Democrats, I'm trying to see what benefit do Democrats have on this issue? Like, I don't think they're getting a political benefit by, quote, having this issue. Mm-hmm. Not solving this problem is a much bigger penalty to them than, quote, having this issue. Now, the Republicans, on the other hand, I think that's where I think they want the issue. Defund the police as a political weapon has been very effective in their minds, and I think they want to keep it. And I do think there are some Republicans who fear that a compromise policing bill, you know, basically takes defund the police off the table.
Well, can we move on to something that warmed
gives
the cockles of
joy,
many people's
Marjorie.
Hearts? was the FBI raid on the law offices and the home of Rudy Giuliani in the early morning. He was there, of course, and I guess he was calling people on the phone as they were going through his belongings, taking cell phones, computers, etc. What are we to make of this?
Well, I want to throw in another aspect of it. You know, the FBI executed a search warrant in another law office here in the Washington area for Victoria Tenzing.
Right.
And the reason I bring this up is think about what it takes. Think about what it takes to get a search warrant, not just for a lawyer, but for a former U.S. attorney.
Yeah.
And then for somebody, you know, Victoria Tenzing's married to Joe DiGenova, also a former U.S. attorney. I mean, think about the level that, you know, when cops have to arrest a fellow cop, right? It means that the evidence must be just so overwhelming they have to do it, right? What I don't think we all fully appreciate is imagine what's in this, or what is the probable cause that they have that they said, yeah, we've got to put former U.S. attorneys' homes on search warrants, the Justice Department. They don't do this lightly for somebody that used to work there. Right? So I think it all looked like what it was, which is that, boy, Rudy, for whatever reason, maybe he's trying to get rich. Maybe he was trying to make money off of what he was doing for Trump on the side. Whatever it is, it smelled fishy. It smelled funny. And it seemed like he didn't care if he was working with Russian intelligence agents or not. You know, maybe he didn't intentionally commit treason, but he ended up stumbling in it, and he didn't seem to give a damn from it. Whatever it is. But the point is, the evidence that they must have, again, they went after a former U.S. attorney. Yeah. I just think that the overwhelming amount of evidence that they have in probable cause for this must just, you know, I can't wait to see it.
I'll tell you, I can't wait to see.
To see this evidence.
How about America's former mayor rooming with Matt Gaetz? That'd be fabulous, don't you think? I think you can see that. You know, my favorite part of this story, by the way, you and Marjorie are discussing serious issues. I am useless today. Right. My favorite part of this story is after the Giuliani raid, his kid, who I haven't heard of in decades or a couple of decades, emerges to say how outrageous it is, which immediately harkens us all back to the great image. Was it during an inauguration for Giuliani when his kid went to the podium and got involved? That was good enough. But even better, Chuck, in the last 24 hours, have you watched Chris Farley's portrayal of the kid at the inauguration?
Oh, it's so good. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right.
Oh, my God.
We missed and mocked. And I remember at the time when I think, it's a 13-year-old kid acting like a 13-year-old kid. But you know what? If you're going to repeat this ridiculousness that he did as a grown adult, then you know what? You're going to get ridiculed. Sorry, buddy.
So one last quick thing in our final minute. I agree with your analysis. I hadn't thought about it in terms of the U.S. attorney thing. I just thought about it in the context of a raid of anybody. But you raised the stakes even further. So does Rudy cut a deal? I mean, there aren't many people higher up that he can turn on. There's one, I guess. Does he cut a deal to save himself here?
I don't know what that deal would be. Who could he offer up?
Yeah.
I mean, it looks like what they seem to have, right, is they seem to have caught him essentially lobbying, so profiting off of. Now, the question is, was it directly, it looks like it's possibly not linked to Trump directly, right? Mm-hmm. That he was doing this sort of, I also stumbled on a business plan too, or it may be that. Now, then again, maybe I'm being naive, and it's, Trump's fingerprints are all over this, but I don't know who he has left to offer up. In fact, I think, frankly, we're going to find out. I am convinced that Paul Manafort is who hooked up Rudy with all of these Ukrainians that were bought off by the Russian intelligence. Because Manafort knew who all those folks were, and suddenly he knew how to find all the disruptors, all the Russian-connected Ukrainians. He was knee-deep in that world. And while Manafort was kind of working with Trump's legal team, Giuliani suddenly gets knowledgeable about Ukrainian politicians. So, I mean, I've got a pretty good theory of how all of this came about. So I don't know who he's got left to throw under the bus.
Well, all I can say,
I don't think there's anybody he can tear in.
Well, I hope you are being naive for obvious reasons. Chuck Todd, a pleasure as always.
Thank you very much, Chuck Todd. Great to talk
to you.
Always, Chuck Todd.
Always. Appreciate it.
Always. Chuck Todd joins us every week. He's the moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston, which is Channel 10 on most providers around here. He's also the host of Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC and the political director for NBC News. Up next, we're opening the lines, taking your calls, asking you about Biden's address. Are you sold on big government or not? Do you want free preschool through college in the first 2 years or not? This is 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan, Jim Browdy. If you're just tuning in, we were talking to Chuck Todd about Biden's address to Congress last night. Now we'll open the lines, ask you, are you sold on big government? After a year of pandemic lockdown, having lost hundreds of thousands of lives to coronavirus, and putting the economy into a medically induced coma, are you ready to ask the country what it can do for you? Biden made the case for big government, saying it was a solution to so many of the nation's problems: racial inequity, gender inequity, economic disparities, gun reform, climate change. I'm sure I'm missing a few. We're taking your calls asking, did you like what you heard or what you saw? The image of Biden standing for the first time as president of the United States before two women on the rostrum. If you're a Republican, did you hear anything last night that appealed to you? Democrats, was there anything that Senator Tim Scott said in his GOP rebuttal that resonated? Or after last night, is it clear there's nothing Biden can do to be a president of unity? 877-301-8970. So I think we know what you thought, Marjorie. You want to elaborate a little bit?
Well, I you know, I'm a big fan of Heather Cox Richardson, who writes this newsletter every day. Very soothing newsletter, by the way. She's a history professor, I think, at Boston College, isn't it?
Boston College, yep.
Yeah. And she's talking about how we have really been moving toward an oligarchy in the United States for about 50 years now, where big money runs everything. So we have fossil fuels and running everything. So it's been difficult to do anything about climate change. We've had the tax system weighted toward the wealthiest people. And it's a decision whether you want the government to do stuff for regular Joe and Janes. I mean, Trump tax cuts did help certain people in the middle class, but certainly not overall middle class. And I think and we all know we desperately need infrastructure. We all know we desperately need help in our educational system. And to me, 2 years of free preschool and 2 years of free community college is a wonderful thing to assure that we can compete. Because I think one of the other big things you talked about is, you know, the world is not waiting for the United States to get its act together.
You mentioned China repeatedly. That was the foil last night.
We can't build a bridge here in the United States, and China's building cities. We can't invest in research and development, and China is leaving us in the dust. What was the book that we read a couple of years ago? We had a guest on.
Oh, Thucydides. Whatever it was.
Basically talking about how China's eating our
lunch. Graham Allison, I think.
The question is, do we want to be left behind because we can't do anything anymore, apparently, in the United States of America, or don't we? So I thought it was a great resetting, and I hope that we don't have so much recalcitrance, you know, with the Joe Manchins of the world or with every single Republican, that we can't get anything big done.
You know, I'm going to comment before we take the calls on something that has absolutely nothing to do with the content. We both are big fans of Lena Wen, who's the former Baltimore Public Health Commissioner. She's a doctor who's on CNN quite regularly. She's also a columnist. They're a contributor, I guess they call her, to the Washington Post. She wrote a piece. Here's the headline: with masks and distancing, Biden's speech sent the wrong message about the power of our vaccines. She's been harping repeatedly on the CDC about not being bold enough in terms of what you're vaccinated, what you can do to encourage people to get vaccinated. Her point, which I never thought of, which was brilliant, I thought, make sure everybody's vaccinated going into the thing last night. To double be sure, have everybody get tested right before to make sure they're not asymptomatic. She mentioned that according to the CDC, 87 million people in this country fully vaccinated. Only 7,000 of them have had infections. That's 0.008%. What should have happened last night is not 200 people, 1,600 people, the usual number. People sitting side by side, and when they walked in, take their masks off to basically show that when you're fully vaccinated, all of you who are not and are hesitant, this is what you can do. What you can't do is be in a room like this with other people and be socializing and sitting next to them if you're not vaccinated. So it's a sidelight, but it's a brilliant sidelight.
She says we have to draw a distinction between what you can do when you're vaccinated and what you can do when you're not vaccinated. And obviously that's going to be a big incentive for people who are not vaccinated to get vaccinated. It was a great piece. She's
great.
Really terrific. And she also says if you had proof of vaccinations, then other things could happen, like concerts and theaters and virtually all businesses could be
like
open.
In 3 months. Right
now.
So if for those of you who didn't stay up for this thing, we'll just play a couple of quick clips and then we'll take your calls. Here is Joe Biden talking about, after laying out the proposals Marjorie was talking about, jobs, infrastructure, etc., talking about global competition, which Marjorie also mentions, and the desperate need for bipartisanship in Washington.
I'd like to meet those who have ideas that are different, they think are better. I welcome those ideas. But the rest of the world is not waiting for us. I just want to be clear. From my perspective, doing nothing is not an option.
And here's Tim Scott, the Republican senator, giving the GOP response on the very same subject, partisanship, or more precisely, bipartisanship.
Last year, under Republican leadership, we passed 5 bipartisan COVID packages. All 5 bills got 90 votes in the Senate. Common sense found common ground. In February, Republicans told President Biden we wanted to keep working together to finish this fight. But Democrats wanted to go it alone. COVID brought Congress together 5 times. This administration pushed us apart.
The other great line he had last night, he says the GOP has worked hard to expand the right to vote. And amazingly, he said it with a straight face. 877-301-8970. There's no question this was Marjorie Coles says the people now are supportive of a bigger government. And that very well may be true, but it was a big government speech last night, which has been out of vogue for quite a while in this country. What'd you think? Caitlin in Providence, you're first. Welcome.
Hi. First, I just want to say I loved the speech. This is the president and the presidency I voted for, so I was very pleased. I got to say, I'm a little sad for Tim Scott. I feel like he kind of just gets trotted out as the token black man in the GOP.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He made that comment about, you know, the government wants to be involved from with the cradle to college. You know, it's just so, the hypocrisy is just too much to handle when the GOP says, you know, Biden wants big government, this is tyranny. Yet at the same time, they want to inspect kids' genitals to make sure that trans kids don't participate in sports. And I can't think of anything more invasive than that.
Fine point.
The cognitive dissonance is just stunning to me.
I think that's well taken. And I think we just heard on the news, by the way, either yesterday or this morning, yet another governor is signing one of those bills that you described. Not dealing with the problems that are consuming America, but dealing with the ones that discriminate against some of our fellow Americans. Caitlin, thanks for the call.
Senator Scott also mentioned abortion. And the problem for the GOP now is that they're at the wrong side of almost every issue in terms of what Americans want. And that's the difficulty. I mean, I don't know if it's they just want to be recalcitrant or if they just are worried about their big money contributions from the Koch brothers or what.
Yeah, but they're favored to take back the House of Representatives in 2022, by the way, despite your data recitation.
Well, maybe. I mean, I know you're talking about the census, right?
That's not
or
just
you're just
the
talking
census,
about the history of
wheeling,
people, the convention,
yeah, midterm
right.
elections, and they only have a 4 or 5
but again,
vote margin
again,
there, 6
again,
votes, 7.
Once we learn, what we learned from Obamacare is that when you give something to people, it's really hard to take it away. So you're going to give these child care tax credits. You're going to give help out people with their daycare, people that are low income. You're going to give these people things. And you know, I think it's a little bit harder to take them away, so
I'm
not
Margaret,
convinced.
You and I have been having this debate for 20 years on the radio. You act like there's a truth squad. When Donald Trump cut taxes $2 trillion, mostly for the rich, I don't remember the Republicans saying, you know, I got to admit, this is really for the rich. What they said was it was a middle-class tax break. You think they're going to go out in the midterms and say, by the way, we're against giving money to people who have kids. We're against that $1,400 check. Essentially, they're going to have voted for everything they voted against. That's the way politics works
in 2021. I don't know. I think if you're getting subsidized daycare and that's a big deal to you and it's changed your life, maybe you might be inclined to look into the position of the person you're going to vote for. I don't know. I could be wrong, but
In Providence, this time in East Providence. It's Wayne. Hello, Wayne. Welcome.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Couple of things about the speech. First of all, I really liked the tone of the speech because it was positive and optimistic, something that we haven't heard in quite some time. All we've heard about for the past 25 years is what we can't do. And here's a president that's saying, this is what we can do. Not that it's going to be easy, but we can do it. And I think that's a very refreshing tone to hear instead of this constant whining about limitations and all this stuff.
Well, with all due respect, Wayne, if I may, Barack Obama was Yes We Can. So I don't think it's fair to say 25 years. There's no question that Donald Trump painted a picture, a far darker picture of our future. Well, but I think Obama was a pretty optimistic kind of character.
Yeah, but he said Yes We Can, but he honestly didn't deliver on some things that I was hoping for.
Well, he did healthcare.
His campaign.
Yeah, well,
he did healthcare. Yes, that's. And the second thing is, and I think that this is different about Joe Biden. I think he gives a real Democrat message. You know, it's he's not telling us that the era of big government is over. He's providing the message that a Democrat really should. That's Democratic theory and that's Democratic ideology.
We got it, Wayne. Thank you.
I don't think we should be surprised.
Thank you very much for your call. We appreciate it, Wayne from East Providence. 877-301-8897. You know what I also liked about last night? It's amazing. What a reversal today. You're doing 100% policy. I'm doing the cosmetics kind of thing. Since there were so few people, despite my endorsing the Lena Wynn perspective, I love the fact that it was not a jack-in-the-box night where there were like 500 Democrats exploding out of their seats. Of course, Nancy Pelosi and Kamala Harris.
Two women behind the podium. One
by the way,
yellow,
which was, I know, was mentioned 1,000 times.
Yeah, it was great.
It was fabulous to see.
When he also said, no president in history has ever said these words. Matt, let's hear it.
Here
that's
it is.
Great.
Here's that moment. I thought it was great, too, right before he spoke what Marjorie just mentioned.
Madam Speaker, Madam Vice President. No president has ever said those words from this podium. No president has ever said those words. And it's about time.
It is about time. That was a pretty nice little opening before he got. He also tried to throw a bone to Mitch McConnell. And he said, you know, Mitch and Chuck, something about down the hall. That went flat kind of thing. But he was trying to connect with, you know, with some of his former Republican colleagues.
If you're going to talk about cosmetics, you know, the last Democrat who ran for president was Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody had the sense, certainly I didn't, that Hillary Clinton, who was giving speeches for Goldman Sachs and making a lot of money on books and all this kind of stuff, had her pulse on what was going on in the country at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, she just didn't kind of get it. And I think Joe Biden shows something different. He's talking about my people being left behind, the people I grew up with being left behind. He's acknowledging that. Mm-hmm. And he has a kind of genuineness that she never had.
By the way, we just got 6,000 emails from women saying Marjorie should lose her job. By the way, it's generally what we get when we criticize anything Hillary Clinton ever did. Sophia in Cambridge. Welcome to the show. Hi, Sophia. Hi.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can. Shoot.
So it makes my blood boil when I hear politicians talk about entitlements, because while the politicians are getting paid their salaries from the taxes I pay, they act like the American public has no right to the money we put into the system.
Great point.
You know, I mean, under Republicans, the one percenters keep getting all the real entitlements via tax breaks while the rest of us continue to pay in, but then get cut out of the so-called welfare programs like Medicaid and Social Security and health care. I mean, that's our money. That's our money. And there seems to become a crime for us to ask to receive something out of it.
So you were happy last night, yes, at least for the first half of the night?
Very happy. I'm living in the reality that we live in every day, and the Republicans are living in their bubble. And while I'm sure their kids will be more than happy to take on any of the quote-unquote entitlements the Democrats are willing to give away, they're just going to stand in their corner and continue to be out of touch with the American public.
Well, by the way, it's not just their kids. It's it's a significant number of their constituents. As Marjorie mentions regularly, polling shows, as she said this to Chuck Todd, it's not just Democrats who like the message. It's a significant chunk of the same Republicans who send those men and women to Congress. So, Sophia, thank you for your perspective. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970.
You know what is another great angle I thought Biden touched on was this idea that we got to decide whether democracy can survive in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. While again, China is leaving us in the dust. Can we function anymore? And I think that's an unanswered question at the moment.
Well, look at Congress. I mean,
exactly.
We discussed this with Charlie Sennett the other day. You know, while Biden's message during that 40-country climate summit with all some of the most important leaders in the world on that virtual gathering was America is back. A legitimate question, even from our allies, is, but can he produce? And it's a question I asked Chuck Todd. I don't know. I'm not convinced. You're much more optimistic about things, appears this day, than I am. I'm not convinced that any of these major pieces of legislation, forget the Republicans, get 50 Democratic votes unless they're dramatically watered down. You know, one of the ironies is that, you know, the Joe Manchin is arguably the most powerful person in the Senate right now. And for those who don't know, he's the West Virginia Democrat who helps get Democrats to 50. And then Kamala Harris breaks the tie. He comes from a state. Can you pick a state that more needs government help than the state of West Virginia, one of the poorest states in the United States of America? I would argue that it's West Virginians who Donald Trump, who Joe Biden was speaking to last night. Yet Manchin is the man who could stop virtually all of this. I mean, there's a certain.
I think we need a mobilization of women. They're the women that are worried about the child care and the daycare and the home health care and the elderly care and all those things. We need some kind of mass mobilization because it can't just be about construction workers building bridges. Jason in the White Mountains. Hi, Jason.
Whoa. Hi, Jason. Hello.
Hi. Can I just, before I thought about the speech, sure. To call a black Republican, as a black Republican, to call a black Republican a token Republican or a token black person, it's really offensive. Like, I'm going to cry. It really hurts to hear people suggest that, like, black people can't have differing opinions. Like, it's really offensive.
Well,
and it's shocking that you didn't push back on that.
Well, actually, I happen to agree with it. That's why I didn't push back on it. I'm sorry you're offended, and you have full opportunity to respond as you're doing it and keep going if you'd like. But the reason we didn't push back is because we agreed with the caller. But continue, Jason.
You're a racist.
Jason, that's the end of the call. Thank you. We were perfectly happy to. We don't call names on this show. We don't do it, and we don't want callers to do it. If you want to call back in a minute and stick to the merits of whatever your point is, we are more than happy to entertain your call, but that's not how this show plays. 877-301-8970.
Gene from Sharon, thank you for calling.
Hey, Gene.
Hey, hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hey.
I'm on the subject of the Republican response. I have to say, I was sitting there thinking of the Groucho Marx line, like, who are you going to believe, me or your own lying eyes? I mean, he's like spinning some version of reality with Biden, who's such a unifying force and trying to unify the country as a divider, when, as far as I recall, he voted to acquit Donald Trump after Trump was convicted of inciting the insurrection against our country.
Impeached.
So who's the divider and who's the uniter? It was like, what? How can you say this?
Well, can I tell you one of the reasons, I mentioned this to Chuck, one of the reasons I'm holding back a little bit on Senator Scott is he can still do a great thing here. As we mentioned, he is the point person appointed by Mitch McConnell to try to negotiate a compromise on the George Floyd Policing Reform Act. And I have to say, I'm not generally a very forgiving person. I would be more than forgiving for last night if it turns out he's able to cut a deal that advances the cause. And Chuck said he worries after last night that it's not going to happen. I'm hopeful that it will.
I agree. But also, you know, words matter. And he says he himself has been profiled, but there's no racism in America. You're like, well, come on, you know?
Gene, thank you.
Yeah.
We got it. We hear your perspective. Thank you very much for the call. 877-301-8970.
Aaron has a good question. You know how you talk about the up and down, people clapping and then not clapping.
Jack-in-the-box stuff, yeah.
Yeah. Aaron wants to know, what kind of person are you if you can't clap for replacing lead drinking water pipes?
Well, by the way, I didn't pick up on this, but either the Washington Post or the New York Times, in their summary of the speech, said when Joe Biden talked about cutting the child poverty rate in half, that not one Republican applauded. Now, I assume that meant they couldn't applaud for the legislation that caused that to happen. But you can't applaud for, you know, by the way, I don't think I've ever credited Ted Cruz with anything. When he wasn't asleep, he did applaud pretty passionately when Joe Biden said everybody should get vaccinated, which frankly surprised me a little bit.
Yeah.
But I think that's an important moment for people who are Ted Cruz fans. My guess is less likely to get vaccinated than a Joe Biden fan. I thought that was great. I just don't understand. I don't understand the whole thing, why you can't be more respectful of the person who is there unless they are doing something totally grotesque. You know, it's just, I don't. And so I actually, in that one regard, like the smaller kind of audience. You always never explained last night. We should have asked Chuck. Do you know the answer? Do you know who from Congress got to go?
How they got picked?
How did they get picked?
I don't know. I was wondering the same thing. Like, you know, you figured, okay, we had one Supreme Court justice. Well, the Chief Justice, John Roberts, was there. That made sense. But I don't know.
Two cabinet secretaries. But that was, they decided for themselves. Obviously, I assume there are a lot of Congress people who wanted to be there who couldn't be there. You know, I also thought, well, I don't want to get into this. 877-301-8897. Oh, actually, we should take a break, Marjorie.
Oh, before we take a break, I want to take Eddie from Fall River now. Because...
Sure.
Eddie, have you seen the former mayor, Jaziel Correa? He's been all over the globe in the papers, on trial at the federal courthouse. It's not looking good for the former mayor of Fall River, huh, Eddie?
It took way too long, my fellow citizen of Fall River, Massachusetts. Marjorie and Jim, we love you here. And yes, it's amazing, the bureaucracy involved here. Marjorie, before I forget, Jim, I just want you to know, Marjorie and I love Fall River. I speak for myself, though, Marjorie. The police here are no different from what happened to the Minneapolis Chauvin case. My sister, I could tell you stories, but the police here in Fall River, some of them are wonderful. The chief is wonderful, but half of the force, somebody was tasered to death on my street. My sister was raped by one. Two of them.
I make a suggestion? If you're going to make those kind of allegations, send us an email to bprwgbh.org.
I will.
Lay out the facts, and then we'll check them out, and then we're happy to have the conversation.
What
are you calling about today, Eddie?
Every police station should be audited, and Joe Biden.
What are you calling about today, Eddie?
Amazing job. Joe Biden, Jim, I'm so sorry. I'll get back on track here.
Shoot.
I think Joe Biden, when he was with Obama as vice president, with the "Oh yes, we can," and every caller, but that one that you had to let go, Jim, was wonderful. And I'm learning from every guest you have, and I just love all the guests you have. But Joe Biden did a absolutely miraculous job last night. I followed him from start to finish, and what Chuck said earlier was phenomenal, I have to say. And I just want to see police with the immunity thing to go away. And Jim, I'm going to get on that email.
Yeah,
you know,
it's
here in Fall River.
It's
BPR at WGBH.org, and put Fall River in the subject matter, so I'll be sure to see it. Eddie, thanks for the call.
We have to take a break.
We are going to take the break right now. The former mayor, it's a great story there, huh? Allegedly extorting the pot shops and all that kind of stuff.
At least from afar, appears he's in a little bit of trouble.
I think he's in a little bit of trouble. I do, yeah. We're talking about President Biden's address to Congress, taking your calls on what resonated and what didn't. That conversation continues on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about President Biden's first joint address to Congress, outlined his vision for the country, his accomplishments, and issued a challenge to Congress to prove that democracy still works. Taking your calls, asking whether what Biden talked about last night was your preferred picture of the future, or did Senator Scott, in his GOP response, paint a picture that makes more sense to you that you prefer? I have to say, in defense of Scott, we've been saying this for years, you and I.
He was much better than a lot of other people who preceded him in that role.
I was just going to say that. There is nothing harder than giving a response, whether you're a Democrat or Republican. Remember Marco Rubio?
Oh, drinking the water every 2 seconds?
Drinking the water thing. And in part because they have no audience. It's unfair to begin with.
Yeah.
But I guess it makes sense. I agree.
He's a good talker.
He's a good talker. He's a very good talker.
Sometimes what he said was not necessarily great. But anyway, Rob from Pembroke. Hi, Rob.
Hey, Rob. Welcome.
Hi, good morning. I thought the speech last night was very well done. Two points I'd like to make. One, I really like the fact that President Biden didn't wait or seek adulation. You know, as people applauded, he listened and then he kept going.
Yeah,
Previous speeches, you know, presidents will wait until it subsides and it gets a little silly after a while. But the main point I wanted to make is that I think what's scaring people a little bit is $1 trillion is a lot of money. Now we're up to six. Mm-hmm. And I think he's got great ideas. If I were him in his administration, I would try to start engaging in activities which really convince people that it's payable in a realistic period of time and for whatever reasons. I remember when Reagan was president, he did this thing once. He said, you know, if you started counting right now for an entire year, every second of every day, you would not reach a billion. And it really was a very powerful way of helping people understand the amount that he was talking about. And I think that's really probably what scaring people a little bit. They love his ideas, but the price tag is getting up there.
But
you
Rob,
know, it's funny you
Rob,
say that.
You know,
I'm sorry, go ahead, Margaret.
He's talking about paying for this. It's with higher taxes on people that make over $400,000 a year, and that's an individual, correct? It's not two people.
Yeah.
It's an individual making over $400,000 a year, which is almost none
sure,
of us.
Actually,
I'm pretty sure it's an individual. We mm-hmm. should double check that, but I'm pretty sure it is. And a change in the rate on corporate taxes. So it's not going to be adding $2 trillion to the deficit as Trump's tax cut was. It's going to be payable in that area. And, you know, I figure if you're making over $400,000, Rob, that's not that big of a deal. And returning to the and they're not even talking about returning to the tax rate that was before. They're talking about going from 21 to 28, I believe, or is it 25? It's certainly not where it was.
You know, Rob, if I can, you know, disagree with you for a second, I think big numbers scare people, but I think the way to do it is break it down into what you get for it. The issue is not so much the spending. What does it mean to me, my family, my community? And I think if you feel that government is providing what you need to live a better life, you'll be more open, you know, rather than playing with numbers. Trillions are scary, but billions are scary, too.
But, Rob, I just want to know, is it the deficit part that scares you? Because it's not going to be.
It doesn't really scare me. I think it's scaring people. And I think I'm not sure they're hearing. He's very good about inserting what his plans are to pay for things. I don't know that that's being emphasized enough. Is it convincing?
But Rob, he didn't have any. Rob, he didn't pay for the $2 trillion a relief plan. It's overwhelmingly popular because 85% of America, just to mention one element of it, got a check. Roughly half or more of American families, come July, are going to get $300 and some dollars, maybe $250 or $300 a month for the child tax credit. And I think it was the biggest bill of its kind in American history, 100% unpaid for. So, I mean, I respect your opinion. I hear you, but I think it's all about, after living through a year of horror, can government do what it's supposed to do to take care of people in need, which is a huge swath of the American people.
The other thing is from what I've read, economists, you know, are concerned about inflation, but there's a lot of economists who argue that now, because interest rates are so low,
exactly,
that this is a great time to be doing all this spending because we're not paying through the shirt on interest. I'm not an economist, I will add. Okay, let's finish up.
I thought you were an economist.
I'm not.
Which means a lot of the things I've said, I got to take back.
I just read these arguments. Anyway, Sam from Dartmouth, thank you for calling.
Hi, Sam.
Hello?
Say something, yep.
Hi. So listen, I just got out of the car. I'm sitting outside in the car in the rain because I love the rain. It makes your hair grow.
That's all I hear. If you're a chia pet, it makes your hair grow. I don't know about humans, but go ahead,
okay,
Sam.
Okay.
So, quick thing about about the last election that we just had. Whenever I had conversation with anybody I used to work with, which I don't work anymore because I'm retired and I love it, but when we start with a conversation about who you're going to vote for, or whatever, and I would say, listen, if you want to start asking about Trump, I already have a toilet. So that would just end the conversation.
Well, I don't think we need to do that. But can I tell you, Sam, for whatever it's worth, 70 million of your neighbors voted for Donald Trump. So 70 million people, and they're not all horrible people, obviously saw something in the guy, you know?
Okay, yeah, so here's what I say about that. It's going to be great because the Republicans are going to have a leg up on the regular people when climate change takes hold and we get flooded with water, because they can all just go right back to what they are, spineless jellyfish.
Okay, Sam, thank you. Thank you. I hope your hair grows long and full and all that kind of thing.
Well, I'm glad Sam's enjoying his retirement.
So here's the note on the $400,000 threshold. On the $400,000 is from our colleagues. A threshold. Biden said in multiple interviews, nobody making under $400,000 will have their taxes increased. But in March, Jen Psaki, who you know is the chief White House spokesperson, muddied the waters and said he meant families. So our colleague thinks we don't have a definitive answer, which is that's pretty pathetic. I don't mean that we don't have a definitive answer, but the fact that it isn't clear is actually pretty pathetic. You think it's individuals.
I thought I read that this morning, Jim, but I could be mistaken.
I don't know. Hey, Han in Lancaster, if you can do it in 30 seconds, it's all yours. Go.
Well, I just wanted to go on about this speech. I know they need money to pay for it, and I got a feeling they're going to go after everybody's IRAs, or when he says he's going to tax Wall Street to pay for stuff, which... I mean, we should just do, if you want Republican help, you have to go with just strict infrastructure. I think you said that later. But to pay for this, and you're going to go after people's individual retirement account, you know, you say you might be taxing Wall Street and big corporations, but when you start saying higher taxes and then you bring in Wall Street, I got a feeling... You know,
who's talking about IRAs?
He's talking slippery slope. Well, when you mention Wall Street, he's saying you start there and you end up doing.
Exactly.
Han, thank you. We got to go only because we're out of time. But thank you for your perspective. By the way, the slippery slope thing is an argument that's going to be used in a lot of these things. You start with high income people. It opens the door. That's usually how tax increases are defeated, Marjorie, by talking about what might happen,
again,
not what is
proposed.
If we're going
to raise taxes, I think we can raise them on people who are, as the New York Times pointed out last week, taking in $20 and $25 million a year in the corporations, and a lot of them aren't even paying any taxes at all. Anyway, coming up, federal prosecutors indict the three men accused of killing Ahmaud Arbery on hate crime and attempted kidnapping charges. And this is this one step closer to justice. Andrew Cabral joins for that conversation and more next on 89.7 GBH. Boston Public Radio.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, Governor Baker has laid out the state's path to normalcy, charting a course to roll back nearly every pandemic restriction by the end of summer. A series of small changes, some starting as early as tomorrow, will likely have significant impact on local businesses, which have been operating with strict limits for more than a year. But are these businesses content? Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Leung will join us.
While many colleges and universities are requiring students to get a COVID vaccine before attending in person this fall, community colleges aren't. They say requiring a vaccine would dampen enrollment and cite differences between traditional four-year institutions with dorm-style living. Former Education Secretary Paul Revel will look at the community college's decision and more. And naturalist and author Simon Montgomery will join us for another edition of the Afternoon Zoo. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan. Jim Browdy is here as well. And, of course, if you get this month's Boston Magazine, you will see that he is among the most powerful and influential men in Boston. We just want to get that on the record. And one other thing we want to get on the record
but
is
there were 70 more powerful people.
There were 70. Jim is number 70, 71. I'm there in a footnote somewhere, I understand.
You are there. You're mentioned.
Little teeny
in the
tiny
piece.
Print. And I just want to clarify what we were talking about before about the, who's going to pay in terms of $400,000. It's an individual paying $400,000, so it's an individual person. But if you're in a married couple, this is according to Axios and the Business Insider, that married couples earning more than $510,000 combined could be paying more too. So if you're
don't confuse it with $510,000. It does not apply to a family. A family making $400,000 is going to see their taxes increase. An individual making less than $400,000 will not see their taxes taxes increase. It only applies, the threshold is an individual, not a family.
That is correct.
Okay.
That is correct. So if you both make 200 grand,
you're fine.
You're fine.
If you both make 250, you're not.
That's right.
In any case, well, you're fine in one regard, but your taxes will probably go up if Joe Biden
gets
his way.
Right, but you know, you can probably squeeze by, I think, on 450 grand.
In any case, joining us online for this week's edition of Law & Order is former Suffolk County Sheriff, former Secretary of Public Safety. She is now the CEO of Ascend. And speaking of Ascend, Andrea, I know it's not my business, but where are you calling us from, Andrea Cabral?
I'm actually calling you from the store.
And why are you there?
Because today is the first day of our soft opening.
Congratulations.
Well, you know, soft opening is an understated sort of opening. You start, you know, you have customers, but you pay attention to, you know, working out any little glitches and things like that. And so, yeah, today is the first day of that.
It's great.
Now, Andrea, I have to say I'm a little disappointed in you because I thought maybe we might get some goodie bags or something like that. You know,
swag.
With your friends and colleagues here on Boston Public. A little swag, you know. What do you think?
Well, we will be doing a grand opening in May. So I will. You are all on the list.
That's
for
great.
The grand opening.
I'll be there.
This is just the soft opening, so don't be. We're still, you know, customers are still welcome, but it's the understated opening.
Okay.
You know, Andrea, before we start on the things that are on the agenda, in a moment of seriousness, I know this. You're the CEO of Ascend. You should spend 30 seconds. We're all assuming that people know what its business is. Could you give us 30 seconds on what you're doing?
Sure. Ascend is a cannabis retail. Actually, the entire company is a vertically integrated cannabis company, which means we have a cultivation and we have retail sites. It's a multi-state, it's an MSO, a multi-state operator.
Mm-hmm.
But in Massachusetts, that means a cultivation and three retail sites. And one of those sites is the site in Boston, which is on 272 Friends Street. And it's called Ascend, and that is the first store to open in Massachusetts for Ascend. So we will have stores opening in Newton and New Bedford later on this year, but this is the flagship store for Boston.
In all seriousness, congratulations. You know, it's been a long wait, and you've been working really hard, so we wish you a lot of luck.
And, you know, may I just say one thing about the stores that where you can legally buy marijuana now, I have been to the one in Brookline that's near me that's in a beautiful old building, is that you go in there and you are told if you haven't done any weed in like 40 years or something, if you're a baby boomer, you know, waiting for an opportunity, they give you help, you know, what dosages and all that. You get a lot of information. So in many ways, it is so much better if you are inclined toward marijuana to have somebody tell you, to know what you're getting, I guess, is a big deal. To me,
right, and that actually happens in two ways. You know, you can go to a company's website. Ours is letsascend.com. The website offers a tutorial on cannabis for people who really want to learn more about it. And then once you're in the store, staff are there to answer any questions that people have, explain products, you know, effects of products. Most people kind of have an understanding of how they want to feel. And can explain that, and then folks at the store are able to help you out. So, our goal is to give everybody this sort of a state-of-the-art cannabis retail experience, and that's what they can expect.
Once again, congratulations, Andrea Cabral.
Okay, Andrea Cabral. Well, let's start with what's going on with Ahmaud Arbery. The Justice Department of the United States of America has indicted this father and son and this other guy for a hate crime in his death. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so particular to this case, it is probably, I can't remember the last time in the past few years that the Justice Department brought federal hate crime charges, and that's relevant to the Ahmaud Arbery case in that, you know, you read about it today and it does cause you to think about all of the work of the Justice Department that was intrinsic to its mission from its inception that stopped during the Trump administration. So oversight of police departments, bringing federal hate crime charges, you know, that came to a fairly swift end under Bill Barr and Donald Trump. What's great is that under Joe Biden, the Justice Department and Merrick Garland, quite frankly, the Justice Department appears to be getting back to its fundamental mission. And in the case of Ahmaud Arbery, for people who may not know or perhaps have forgotten, Ahmaud Arbery was jogging in a Georgia neighborhood and stopped into a house that was under construction and was just sort of looking around, as people do when they see a house under construction, to see, you know, how it's being built and so on and so forth. He was essentially hunted and lynched by three men, Travis McMichael, Gregory McMichael, and William Bryan, who not only chased him in their truck, armed with rifles, they chased him with using two trucks, one of which, allegedly driven by William Bryan, was used to cut off Arbery's path as he was trying to escape them. They boxed him in, got out of the truck, and essentially shot him to death. While at least one of them was flinging racial epithets over his dead or dying body. And so Georgia does not have a hate crime statute, so there's no surprise there. And the federal government has indicted each of them on one count of federal hate crimes violation, or violations of the hate crime law. So that in addition to the prosecution at the state level for the actual killing of Ahmaud Arbery, they also face federal charges.
You know, I really hate to speak for somebody else who's done a lot of academic work, but just to summarize, we had Saida Grundy on with us from BU yesterday, who's not a huge fan of hate crimes. And she, again, I'm going to try to put words in her mouth, but I'll stop there and just ask you a broader question in a second. Her contention is that hate crime legislation rarely leads to people being prosecuted who wouldn't otherwise be prosecuted. It just leads to longer sentences. And again, we can leave her other arguments aside. But in light of the fact that the three men in this case have been indicted on murder charges in Georgia, what is the importance of the federal government coming after them on this hate crime stuff?
Well, I think for the Justice Department, it has always been the hate crimes prosecutions and civil rights violation prosecutions have always been, there have been penalty enhancers. In some cases, and historically, the federal charges were the only charges that would ever be fought against someone, because the, if you remember, Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman, the three civil rights workers that were murdered in Meridian, Mississippi, and buried in an earthen dam, the sheriff's deputy and the sheriff himself were among those that were indicted for that. None of them, there wasn't a prosecution there. And the federal government actually stepped in. I mean, ultimately, I think they ended up being a state prosecution. But that's the Justice Department's sort of genesis, is stepping in where states absolutely refused to punish these crimes. As states began to punish them more, it still was important and still remains important that when people are targeted because of who they are, because of their immutable characteristics of gender or race, because of their religion, those are crimes that need particular attention paid to them because of who we say we are anyway, as a democracy in this country. So yes, is it, you can be prosecuted at the state level and you can, and for the actual crime itself, but your motivation in committing that crime still makes a difference in this country. And we've gotten back to that under Joe Biden and Merrick Garland.
We're talking to Andrea Cabral.
Andrea Cabral, a Superior Court judge in North Carolina has said that he's ruled against a bunch of media outlets who are trying to release the body camera footage of this shooting of Andrew Brown Jr. in his driveway. He was shot multiple times and killed. The judge said that he will release it to the family, but not the public through the news media, and the decision was based on affecting a trial or jeopardizing the safety of the deputies in question, even though the video he's going to release to the family would blur the features and the name tags of the officers. So I don't know what to make of this decision. What do you make of it?
Neither do I. And first of all, it's a, you know, I think North Carolina is sort of an outlier been not considering body cam footage to sort of automatically be public record. And
they
and
are.
The reason I say that is that it's that's important. If something is automatically a public record, the burden to show that it is not a public record shifts, right? It is presumptively supposed to be released to the public. So it is not incumbent upon the public or any particular plaintiff or member of the media to prove that it ought to be a public record. North Carolina is different. It's not an automatic public record, and they have judges that actually decide it. So I'm at an equal, not only does that put the burden on the person or the group seeking the body cam footage to prove that it is worthy of being disseminated or to push back against a ruling that says that it is not to be disseminated, you know, it creates these sort of layers of oversight and perspective, for lack of a better term, that could that likely result in it not being released to the public. I'm not I'm at a loss as well. I'm not sure how not releasing it to the public serves the public's interest, especially to your point, Marjorie, that where faces can be blurred and identities wouldn't be a violation of anybody's privacy.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you say you don't know what to make of it. What I make of it is it's yet another effort to ensure there is not transparency for the public. You know, you don't have to travel to this judge's courtroom in the Andrew Brown Jr. case. It's not dissimilar from the fact that the city of Boston decided until they were their backs were up against the wall that we shouldn't see the internal affair documents.
That's a great point.
And the case of Patrick Rose Sr., obviously that was not video, but it was a record. I think most entities in positions of authority resist transparency, particularly when it comes to police, until they're forced by either laws or public pressure to be transparent. That's a fair statement, Andrea, isn't it?
Oh, you know, I believe that that's true. What puzzles me is that, you know, judges should be a little bit different, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
Government agencies and departments, which may have, you know, be inherently more motivated towards secrecy versus transparency, the court is talk about a presumption. The court is presumptively supposed to be acting in the public's interest, mindful of the individual rights of the people that come mm-hmm. before it. And that's why I thought Marjorie's point was well made, that if you're not violating anybody's privacy rights, how do you overcome this significant public policy interest in wanting to see what's on this video?
Yes, indeed.
You know, Andrew, speaking of videos, we've had videos released of cops pepper spraying a 9-year-old girl in Rochester, New York, choking a 13-year-old boy in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and wrestling an 11-year-old girl to the ground in Framingham, New Mexico. These are all raised in a story questioning police training about violently killing children, and they, of course, mention Adam Toledo, who was 13, the one that was shot when he had his hands in the air. He may have had a gun before that, but he had his hands in the air when the officer when he turned around and faced the officer and was shot. And Makai Bryant, the 16-year-old who was shot as well when she was wielding a knife toward another teenager. I guess we don't separate out, and probably we should, violence against kids from the cops.
Yeah, I think we did probably a better job at this a long time ago before we started putting police officers in our schools and before we got to the point of being afraid of our own children, which is fairly widespread and has its genesis in lots of different things, including notions about super predators and super gangs and, you know, all of the kind of stuff that happened sort of in the 80s and the 90s. Around this, there's never, you know, the problem is always that there's not enough balance, right?
Yeah.
So you can have a rise in juvenile crime, and God knows, you know, there was probably no greater amount of juvenile crime than, you know, London. I mean, Charles Dickens wrote Oliver Twist, you know, because of it.
Yeah,
but, you know,
that's right.
kids used to get, you know, it, they basically would throw them in jail as well, but they often would just put them on a ship and send them here. yeah, that's kind of, you know, how the country started with juvenile pickpockets. But, you know, the idea that as we were told to fear our children more, along with taking away the support and the funding for many of the social ills that, you know, run sort of parallel, increases of problems in homes and then juvenile crime. We sort of did this militarization or over-policing as an answer to not really dealing with the actual fundamental problems that create a certain level of crime among juveniles. But we also sort of failed to balance that, whatever those increases were, against what our goals and mission should be as a criminal justice system. Some of that we've done a little bit better at, where we start to recognize the juvenile adolescent brain is, you know, that's being the science of the underdevelopment of that is being recognized more and more, and not, you know, having laws that prohibit the death penalty or life without the possibility of parole for juveniles who are convicted even of serious murders, at least without a hearing. So we're making some progress there, but none of that gets at the frontline presence of police in the lives of children, in their schools, on their streets, and more often than it should be, in their homes. And the fact that police are treating children the same way they treat adults. That is not only a failure of policing, but it's also a failure of common sense. Police, you know they're dealing with children. What could cause you to wrestle a 13-year-old to the ground? Several police officers needed to do that. Or pepper spray a 9-year-old girl. Or zip tie a 6-year-old girl.
Yes, in Orlando, Florida. That's, I saw that.
The insanity of that and the inability of the actual police officer to understand a commensurate use of force, notwithstanding that that officer probably shouldn't even be on the scene of that particular incident, can't understand a commensurate use of force with a 6-year-old, with a 13-year-old, with an 11-year-old. That speaks to the fitness of that particular police officer to me.
Well, yeah, but there's a corollary point here, too, is that this will shock nobody listening. While there is a systemic problem, as you and Marjorie have described, white kids are treated far more like children by police authorities than are kids of color. There's this the Sentencing Project put out numbers. 14% of all minors in the country are black kids, but black children make up 77% of the people in juvenile facilities. And they go on to say, this is an NBC report, police often criminalize black children for conduct considered common among kids, like mouthing off or fighting at school. It's not just police. We've discussed, I think, with you, but I know maybe with Paul Revel, I'm not sure, that intra-school discipline for the exact same behavior is much more severe when that same behavior is done by a kid of color rather than a white kid. So there's not only a sort of an across-the-board problem, but there's a racial divide problem like there isn't so much of policing and disciplinary work, Andrea Cabral.
Right. It should be said, but it almost goes without saying at this point, given the myriad studies that show disparate treatment in policing. And, you know, white police officers see their own children reflected when they are confronting a white child. Black children are not seen as children, particularly young black boys, but certainly young black girls as well. They are seen as defendants. They are seen as pre-criminals, if not actual criminals. And that accounts for both the numbers of arrests, which, to your point, far exceed that of white children, but the level of violence shown toward them. I mean, when the 9-year-old girl was pepper sprayed and the police officer said she's crying in the back, she's in the back seat of a police car and it's pepper sprayed. They literally fill the backseat of their own cruiser with pepper spray in order to pepper spray a 9-year-old girl. And the police officer, said something to her. I forget what the exact comment was. And her comment back was, but I am a 9-year-old girl.
No, I'll tell you what the line was. I was going to say that. The cop said to her, you're acting like a child. And her yes. response was, I am a child.
Yes. Yes. Right. And so she literally, with pepper spray in her eyes, had to point out to the police officer that he was unable to see her as a child. That has to be pointed out by someone who is under violence by a police officer. A child that is under violence by a police officer is insane. And if you match that to the sheer number of black men, black women, particularly unarmed black men and black women, who are being killed on a daily basis, 7 people were shot while the Chauvin trial was going on. Yeah. If you look at this through line, anyone who says that policing ought not to be reformed, that the funding for police officers ought not to be decreased and go to places where social services and other kinds of mechanisms for help, that we ought not to have a shift in how and when certain elements of the public believe the police should be called to the scene of an incident, and the police officers and department's capacity to respond to certain kinds of incidents that involve mental health and other things. Anyone who thinks that none of that is necessary in the face of mass death, daily death and daily violence. It always has been there, but there's quite a little through line going on now. And it might be, to Will Smith's point, just, not that there's anything is really that different, but it's just being filmed now. That may be true. But the bottom line is that this has to be reformed, and it has to be reformed now.
Well, Andrew Cabral, calling us from 272 Friends Street. We should say soft opening today.
Yep. Put us on the list for the grand opening.
And we're out of time, but if you could text Marjorie with the email, with the web address where she can apply for an internship, that'd be terrific. Thank you. Andrew Cabral, congratulations.
Okay, Andrew,
and good
talk
luck
soon.
There.
Thank you very much. Andrew Cabral joins us every week for Law and Order. She's the former Suffolk County Sheriff and Secretary of Public Safety, and now the CEO of Ascend, which is having its soft opening today. Thanks a lot, Andrea. Coming up, why are the high-rises going up in downtown Boston when current office spaces are still empty? Who's going to rent those places out? The Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Leon joins us for that and more. Listen to 89.7 Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie and Jim Browdy. If there was a defining indicator that we're returning to pre-pandemic norms, it's the ball pit revival. As part of Governor Baker's reopening timeline, this is true, starting August 1st, ball pits will be open for business, along with indoor water parks and dance clubs. In the immediate future, I think it's May 10th, Baker's rollbacks include expanding capacity in ballparks and stadiums, I think from 12 to 25% at the end of May. Restaurants can loosen restrictions by increasing indoor capacity to 10 people per table. Bars can start selling drinks without serving food. And I'm pretty sure tomorrow is the day that you can stop wearing masks outside unless you're not distanced from people. It's good news for businesses, but did they need to wait this long for these rollbacks to go into effect? Or was Baker's timing just right? Joining us online for her take on this and other business headlines is Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Leung. She, of course, is a GBH contributor. Hey there, Shirley.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hi.
Hey, ball pits.
Ball pits.
Ball pits. Can't
Your
wait
kids
for
probably
the kids
love ball
those.
Pits, right?
Well, I don't know if you guys saw the political newsletter, the local political newsletter editor, Stephanie Murray.
Stephanie Murray, I did.
Yeah, she did a whole expose on who's behind the ball pit lobby. And and I wrote to her. I said, you know what? I don't know why you call Chuck E. Cheese's. They don't have ball pits at Chuck E. Cheese's. Mm-hmm. The ball pits that I'm familiar with are IKEA, right? IKEA has that ball pit in the front of their stores. And also the trampoline parks, they tend to have foam pits. So that's where we need to get to the bottom
Well, it sounds like Shirley Leung is the ball pit lobby, actually.
Well, Shirley Leung, they used to have Chuck E. Cheese ball pits. Oh, my God.
They did. I think they got rid of it. Well, at least the one that we go in Everett, the one in Everett, there's no ball pit there.
Yeah, well, that's good. Very sad. They're a little nerve-wracking if you're worried about germs or COVID-19, I guess. But Shirley, you know, there's no distinction. We talked earlier about Lena Wen. Jim and I are a big fan of her. You've probably seen her on TV. She's a physician. She knows a lot about, you know, COVID. She's talked about COVID endlessly. And talking about there needs to be a distinction between what the vaccinated and unvaccinated can do. There seems to be no distinction here in Massachusetts. I mean, it's great, I guess, that these things are reopening. But when we have lots of people that don't want to get vaccinated or have not been able to get vaccinated yet, you know what I mean? No distinction.
Yeah, no, it's we're in a kind of a brave new world here. And, you know, right now, the government is, you know, kind of leaving it up to individuals, right, to make a choice about whether you're vaccinated or unvaccinated and whether or not you get together with other people or do certain things. Like, I was just trying to arrange a small group of colleagues for drinks at a restaurant, right, and outdoors. And, you know, some people are like, I'm not fully vaccinated, so I'm out. You know, I'm not going to any restaurants right now. So then I realized, like, oh, I should have prefaced my invitation with, you know, what are you comfortable with? Are you comfortable with going to a restaurant? Do you want to meet outside? I don't think anybody is comfortable indoors quite yet, but I figured I'd stick it. But it's very complicated and very messy right now.
Yeah, but, you know, I don't know if you read your colleague Joan Vanocki's piece today suggesting that she believes that Charlie Baker's running for a third term, even though he hasn't announced. And she cites something that was said yesterday on our show by Maura Healey. Well, Baker, every time he's been asked about vaccine passports or mandatory vaccinations, he basically says, let it play out. Let's give it a little bit of time. She had said to us a month ago, state cops and correction officers should be required to have vaccines. She said that all public employees who have interaction with the public should be required to be vaccinated. So you have one of the few issues of conflict, other than maybe philosophy, which I'm not downplaying at all, between the popular incumbent governor and the popular attorney general, who a lot of people believe wants to be governor someday. That's a pretty dramatically different perspective in terms of how to do reopening, Shirley.
It is, and it doesn't surprise me. You probably all remember when recently Baker was asked the question about vaccine passports, how he felt about that, right? And the requirement, and that he just went off. He was really upset that we would even start to begin to think about requiring vaccine passports, or even having the notion of them, when not everybody has even had a chance to get vaccinated. And so, we might see, going forward. I can see, you know, now, you know, in a month or two, everybody will be, right now, everybody has an opportunity to get vaccinated, except for the kids, right? Mm-hmm. Teenagers, yes. And so moving forward, I mean, this will be a big, this, I think we're starting to see the beginnings of a big debate on how we should move forward. I mean, think about I've been working on a story about India. I mean, and what are the lessons learned from India? I mean, not that long ago, the beginning of the year, India seemed like they had conquered hope. And now they're in this devastating second wave. And so I think there will be a lot of discussion of, how fast should we reopen? I mean, one of the things that's happening now is that, you know, Baker is pushed out the opening pretty far out to August 1st of fully reopening compared to Rhode Island and Connecticut and even New York. New York, I think today, de Blasio said we're fully reopening July 1st. Connecticut, Rhode Island, end of May, largely fully reopen. And so that means for the tourism industry here, right, in Massachusetts, summer could be a wash for them. And they're pretty up in arms about that.
Yeah, I don't understand his reluctance on the vaccines, because it seems to me what you're doing by saying we'll open it to anybody is, in some ways, you're punishing the people who have been vaccinated.
who don't really want to go to places where they're, even if they can only get a mild disease, they don't want to get COVID and they get vaccinated.
Yeah, but I don't know about punishing them, Marjorie. I would argue you're taking away an important incentive. Getting back to Dr. Lena Nguyen, her view is tell the public all the things you can do only if you're vaccinated.
But do you want to go to Fenway Park if you're surrounded by people who are unvaccinated?
I'm not crazy about it, but I would say they're at far greater risk than I am at Fenway Park. But I agree. Listen, I'm agreeing with you. I believe that we should mandate it in a lot of these settings if people want to go to certain places. But Baker is obviously...
Well, it seems like the governor, I mean, it's his Republican philosophy, right? I mean, he doesn't want, he would favor a less intrusive government, right? And so he's going to leave it up to the private sector. I mean, leave it up to the Fenway Parks or leave it up to individual restaurants to make that decision on whether that they would, mandate a vaccine. Now, but what Healy is saying, though, is, Baker has a lot of employees, public employees. Yeah. He actually can, if he wanted to, he could mandate public employees to get vaccinated. Employees that face the public, have them make sure they get the vaccine. And that would probably help with making sure that more of us are vaccinated.
I want to be fair to Governor Baker for a second, though. While you said, his Republican philosophy is less, and I agree with that, less government involvement, intervention, intrusion, whatever word you want to use. There are not many Democrats other than Maura Healey who would say what Maura Healey said to us the other day. The vast majority of Democrats are not saying, let's have a broad mandate. So he's not really much of an outlier, I don't think, on that front. It just happens to have a different of opinion with the highest ranking Democrat in the state, Maura Healey. We're talking to Shirley Young. Now, Shirley, this is a great piece in your paper. I don't even know who wrote it. Tim Logan. The whole notion, I've asked you this, I think, but now I'll ask you again. I don't understand if it turns out we're learning that so many businesses are not going to require their workers to come back full time, that hybrid appears to be the future. How is it that millions of square feet of office construction is going ahead full steam? Who's going to fill these spots?
Well, a lot of the buildings that Tim is talking about, I mean, they're under construction, right?
Right.
You kind of have to, they've been financed and they're basically finishing what they started. And so I think his story said there's going to be, several millions of square feet on the market and then a couple years. And there was a separate story by my colleague, John Chesto, about the hybrid model. Yeah, and I think there's a survey in that story that said that something like, before the pandemic, 90% of the employers said that they required their employees to come to work 5 days a week. After the pandemic, they think that they're only required 20%. They think only 20% require employees to come back 5 days a week. And no surprise, as a result, I think 40% of the employers in the survey said they're going to shrink their footprint. So we do have a really big vacancy rate right now, commercial office space. I think it's almost 16%. That's almost double what was from last year. And so what was great about Tim's story is that he followed like developers like Tim O'Brien, Tom O'Brien, who's building, I think, One Congress, and all of them are getting very creative in their marketing. And it seems like the push from those with new towers under construction is new construction. We can build a healthier environment. We have better ventilation systems. So I think that's so the new construction is they're hoping that companies will flock to them because they're newer. They can create healthier, better ventilated areas versus the older stock here in Boston.
There's no question about that. But the bottom line is whether people shift from old buildings to newer buildings, the number of office workers working in these places is going to be down. I mean, there's no question about that, right?
So yeah, I, there's Right. There's no question. And it's not going to only have an impact on, you know, the commercial real estate market, trying to fill those offices.
Restaurants.
Restaurants, right. Yeah. Shop around. I mean, just to think about it, if 20% fewer office workers came to downtown on any given day, you're not going to have as many restaurants and shops around. They're not going to be able to.
Didn't you write the piece? I think you wrote a piece like 6 months ago in the middle of the pandemic. Didn't you walk down Newbury Street and wasn't that you?
Yes, I did a few stories like this.
Right.
In May, when the first kind of reopening of retail and it was, I mean, Newbury Street was already, you know, emptying out already. And it was pretty empty there when I was there that day. And one thing I didn't realize, I forget, Newbury Street sits in the shadow of the Prudential Center.
That was the most impressive part of your story to me, is right. You don't think about that.
Yeah.
Right. I remember the barbershop on Newbury Street was saying, listen, I don't have the office workers are not flooding, coming out, pouring out of the towers and getting their haircut on their lunch break. That's what I need. And so I didn't even think about that. I just think of it as, oh, me leisurely shopping or lunching on Newbury Street. But all those thousands of office workers are critical. And so there'll be another shakeup on Newbury Street for sure.
Let me just say one last thing about this. And we keep complimenting the mayoral field, which I think is terrific. And I know Marjorie shares that view. A critical issue for them in the debates as we move to September and November is what are they going to do for all these businesses in light of the fact that it best case scenario is that it's years before all this office space is filled again. In that interim period, what are they going to do to make sure the business is dependent, as you wrote on the Prue, for example, or any of these other businesses are able to survive? So I hope they think a lot about.
Yeah, I think they'll have to be. And I think when I think about previous elections, I don't think small business was really the future of small businesses in Boston was top of mind. But I think right now it is. And I think you're going to see a lot of candidates talking about how to help the small business community recover. I also think of, again, back to tourism, every city, you talked about this, but Boston just launched the all-inclusive tourism campaign. It's very first ever tourism campaign. I think it's spending about $2.5 million. But everyone is kind of tapping COVID money or federal relief money to do this. What I was being told was that, yes, this is incredible that Boston is doing this, $2.5 million. But, you know, I think New York is spending like $20 million. I think Baltimore is spending $5 million. So we're really in like almost a tourism arms race here. And so I'm hoping that, after we spend the $2.5 million, we think about spending more, because I think we'll need to remind people that Boston is open for business. We may still be under restrictions, but still come to Boston and spend your vacation dollars.
We're talking to Shirley Young, business columnist for the Boston Globe. Shirley, you wrote a really disturbing piece about violence against elderly Asian Americans rising, even around here in Boston. And you started out with this brutal assault on this Chinese American woman in her 70s in Medford. Tell us about it.
It happened in broad daylight, and I wanted to write about elderly Asian Americans in the Boston area because we haven't had the viral videos that we've seen in New York, very disturbing videos in New York and San Francisco about elderly Asian Americans being attacked. And I had heard about her situation through other contacts, and first she didn't really want to talk, but then she decided to open. But what made her open up was that this, she was doing her daily walk in Medford. Like other elderly Asian Americans I spoke to, I mean, she covered up. She has a hat on. She has glasses. She tries to hide her Asianness. Right.
She's
got her mask on. And yet she still was, shoved to the ground. She hit her head on the curb. She was bleeding. She thinks that she suffered a concussion. But the reason why she ended up talking to me was because she's like,
Shirley, I was sitting on the curb. I'm holding a tissue to my head. I'm bleeding and no one stopped to help me.
Oh.
And she just kept on thinking, this is what was like with that 65-year-old Filipino woman in New York, was caught on that security video where she was attacked. And you see on the video, the security guards, right, just, watch and then lock the doors and don't come out to help her. And she's like, what is that about? Why aren't people treating me like a human being? And I mean, the other element of her story is that she didn't report it to the police. Yeah. She didn't trust the police. And I spoke to the Medford police about this. And they said, you know, they encourage her to report it or her friends to report it. They know that, you know, victims don't like to deal with the police. I think one of the startling things about my story was that, you know, Medford has a sizable Asian American population, as does Quincy, as does Lowell. And when I talked to those police departments, they said we don't have a single report of anti-Asian hate crime in the past year, which is pretty, which is a sign to me that this doesn't mean hate does not live there. It means that there's something wrong with the system, that Asian Americans aren't reporting it and the police aren't monitoring the community close enough to detect that they're not reporting it.
So we broached your story yesterday with, again, I can't remember if it was yesterday or the day before, the Attorney General, and she showed great concern for it and talked about outreach and that sort of stuff. But so what's your prescription for the failure to report? What would you like to see local police departments, the Attorney General's office? What has to happen so that people like Ms. Shen feel comfortable, hopefully are safe, but if they're not safe in individual circumstances, they feel comfortable reporting what was done to them?
Well, I assume Attorney General Healey talked about her hate crimes bill, right?
She did.
That she is, right. You know, first step is to kind of strengthen the existing laws so that when you do report a hate crime, there's accountability. I think a lot of these things don't get prosecuted. So it at one point, you're like, well, what's the point, right? Reporting, going through the process of reporting a hate crime if nothing happens in the end to the suspects. And, I talked to Ms. Shen about this. You know, what would make you feel comfortable? Because I was telling her, you know, report, you need to find a way to report. Okay, fine. You don't feel comfortable with police, you know, report it somewhere else. And apparently, I did hear from actually a city council member from Medford, and they said I heard from someone else that there is a civil rights civilian side reporting system. Like you can report to the Human Rights Commission. There's a way to file a civil complaint. And so it's almost like one step removed from if you don't want to deal with the police, you don't trust the police, you file a civil complaint, and then you can have the police look into it from there, you know? And so I think my biggest kind of concern is that when we don't see these reports, and the police, Medford police officer acknowledges, it's like, if we don't have reports of a hate crime, we assume there isn't hate crime here. And so I think there needs to be more trust between, you know, communities of color and the police. Of course, this is a huge issue right now, right? But maybe there's an alternative reporting system, you know, a little buffer so that at least we can monitor and track hate crime.
Well, I have to say, you keeping your focus on this, I think this is a real important part of the fix, whatever the fix ends up being. So it was another terrific piece, Shirley. Yeah,
thanks a lot, Shirley.
Thank you.
Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Leung joins us every week. She's also a GBH contributor. Coming up, Paul Revel joins us to go over the latest education headlines. Paul Revel is next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And it's the big mandate on campus. The state university system and other colleges and universities, not all of them, but a lot of them throughout Massachusetts, say students must get vaccinated against COVID to come back in the fall. This is one of Marjorie's pet peeves coming up. The state's community colleges, however, are not. They're arguing that a vaccine mandate is putting too much of a burden on students, but isn't failing to mandate a vaccine, putting a burden on society. Join us online for his take on this and other education headlines as former state secretary of education. That'd be Paul Revel. Paul's a professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Redesign Lab. His latest book, co-authored with Lynn Sachs, is Collaborative Action for Equity and Opportunity, a Practical Guide for School and Community Leaders. Talk about timely. Paul, good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, Jim and Marjorie, even on a gray day.
Yeah, I know, but it's getting warmer every day. Paul Revel, you wrote this great opinion piece for The Globe talking about almost a utopia for our schools, where you'd have, you know, tutoring, summer school, acceleration program, not structuring, as I think you put it, teaching to the average kid, but individualized teaching for each kid, you know, home visits, teacher and family and teacher-student meetings, all this stuff. And I was so excited reading it, and then I thought, wait a minute, we fought for 5 or 10 years in Boston to get a 45 minutes longer school day, and I still don't think we have it. So, I mean, this
don't
sounds
be so
a lot
pessimistic, Marjorie. You know, I think we got a moment to make some change. Now, maybe in the past 4 or 5 years we haven't had those moments to capitalize on now. But you know, I happen to think now with this American Rescue Plan coming down the road and more commitments coming from the new administration, suddenly we're going to have some money to do some substantial changes. It's too bad in education that anytime you propose change, there's a Pavlovian response that automatically says it takes more money. But right. Be that as it may, we have more money and we have a sense of urgency about, you know, and I've seen some broad surveys of parents. Parents are looking for significant changes now. And so what I was trying to propose in the article was, a vision of what it might look like. But the other thing in that article was just a caution that we hear a lot of talk about, you know, let's move directly into tutoring and intensive academics and filling the gap that's undeniable, that's developed. And we need to attend to that gap. People really have lost learning opportunities over the course of the past year, and it's been differential. Some children have been more affected than others, and we need to make up for that. But the first step has got to be, you know, drawing students back into the process of learning, reestablishing relationships, reconnecting them to the process of learning, building their engagement, their motivation, drawing them out of their cocoons and getting them, you know, out and physically active. I mean, summer's a great opportunity to do all kinds of enrichment activities and just, you know, sort of rebuild the structure of relationships that has to underpin any kind of effective education. So that's, I think, the cart. Let's put it this way. By focusing exclusively on the academic dimension of this, we're putting the cart before the horse. We need to pay attention to relationships and where kids are coming from and re-engage them first before we go full bore on filling the academic gaps.
You know, let me say about four things about your piece, which I thought was great, even though, you know, I am skeptical about our ability or willingness or whatever, like Marjorie is. But let's stay with it for a minute. I meant to quote a guy from The Globe to Shirley DeYoung a minute ago, the head of State Street Corp, who said, you know, now is the only time we're going to have in this lifetime to rethink what the office looks like, because obviously it's almost a blank slate. Same with education. If we don't do something like you're talking about, some sort of radical transformation, when we have this opening to do it, then I would say, you know, fold up your tent and move on. And the two things you say that I think are really important to come out of the column, both of which you may have said here before, but I forget. One, this notion that there be a navigator for every kid or family.
Yeah, I love that.
To help them work through all of the hurdles and questions and whatever every family has. I mean, I'm an upper middle class family, and I know we had a million when our kids were in the public schools here in Cambridge. I'm sure Marjorie was in the same situation. That's brilliant. And then if you shake your head reading Paul Rebel's piece and say, well, that's not real, the point you make that is so obvious and true, when you go, when you're a kid and you enter the healthcare system, people, the doctor doesn't say, well, you're 13 years old, so you're in a certain class of people. We'll treat you in the way we treated the other 21, 13-year-olds that were here yesterday. They treat you based right. upon where you are. And while it may be a huge and maybe unachievable step from here to there, it is so obvious that the same thing has to be done in education. So convince me and Marjorie that there, other than just the availability of additional funds from the feds, that there is an environment, a willingness on the part of the unions, a boldness on the part of administrators to do the kind of thing you're talking about, Paul Revel.
Well, thanks, Jim. I think that, number one, we know it's possible. So one thing that you have to say to educators, many of whom, most of whom went into the business because they wanted to have a positive impact in children's lives.
Right.
And they know that for a substantial number of our children, we're not having that positive impact. And the notion of getting teachers more deeply engaged in helping students find their way through the opportunities and the supports and the services and the kinds of extra help and tailored support that we take for granted you get in the medical system. Or for that matter, in business, I mean, everybody's about niche marketing, about yeah. tailoring, about customization, about personalization. And why should we in education lag behind on that? We typically confuse equity and equality. We think that the fair thing to do is give everybody the same thing. But it actually is not the fair thing to do because the needs of children are so very different. If you just look at this pandemic, some kids have had full support. 24/7 from two professional parents, both of whom were working from home and able to attend to them and support them on the internet and then provide mm-hmm. all kinds of supports outside. And other kids haven't had that. So I think we've got enough demonstration. For example, I forget whether I cited in the piece, but the city of Nashville, who has 26,000 students, about half of what Boston has assigned a navigator to every student in that school system. So this is on the ground and it's working. We've done it. I visited a place in rural Illinois where they'd adopted this approach. And the teachers came back after their initial interviews with students as they began to do a diagnostic and develop a portfolio for each child. I remember one teacher saying to me, this is why I went into education in the first place. This was the deepest conversation I ever had with a student. And I connected with the family. This is why I want to do this kind of work. So I think it's possible. I think unions are always talking about deepening the professionalism of teachers and enabling them to have discretion in their work. So I think it appeals to some of the things that the unions have been pushing for. And again, with the additional resources we have, to your first point, if we fail to show that we can make a difference, that we can act and work differently and get better results as a result of this investment that's being made by the federal government, then I think we've lost the public's confidence for a long time to come, and there will be no further investments in education. We'll be pushed to the side. They'll do a workaround with respect to education. So I think everybody in the profession has an interest now mm-hmm. in taking full advantage of this opportunity. We know there are going to be instances around the country where money is wasted. This is a lot of money coming down the pike. And we know there'll be places where it's going to be wasted. So we've got to make sure that we have some sterling demonstration sites where this money went to work and made a difference for students and their families.
Well, I hope we have some demonstration sites. I mean, the schools are all opening now. We're going to have the high schools back on May 17th. So we are at that moment right now. But in any case, the Mass Board of Education says the MCAS graduation requirement should be waived for the class of 2022, and the class of 2022 is going to be back in just a few weeks. Is this the right move in the MCAS?
I think it is. I think in the near term, particularly in that it's difficult for students to access the additional opportunities they might need to take the test in order to qualify for graduation, that it's reasonable. You know, it's, an assessment and accountability system has lots of features. One is, you know, diagnostically measuring progress. The other is, you know, adjusting accountability consequences from help and support to measures that relate to holding students back from graduation because they don't have the skills and knowledge ready to be successful at the next stage. I think under the circumstances, it's reasonable to waive the requirement, which is not the same thing as saying what a lot of folks out there, including organizations like the Mass Teachers Association, want to push for eliminating accountability altogether. And I just think that's the wrong move. There are things that need to be adjusted and improved about our accountability system. But in virtually every walk of life, I mean, look at policing now. All the talk is about accountability. People want folks who receive public dollars to perform a public service to be accountable and show that the money makes a difference and it's being spent fairly and it's being spent under transparent circumstances. So we've got to work on improving our accountability and assessment system, which is really an equity system. It's designed to say, let's set high goals for everybody. Let's measure progress. And let's insist that the system do better, especially with those populations that it's least well served. So I hope as a Commonwealth we can move in that direction.
Jim, would you like to say a few words about how no one should be accountable in the school systems?
I believe that no one should be accountable in the school system. Those are a few words. That is not true, of course.
Your mantra is give us more money and leave us alone. Right?
Exactly. I don't believe that, by the way. Marjorie, just wanted to make Marjorie happy.
No, by the way, Paul. I know you don't.
If you can give us just 30 seconds to further answer the question that we started the day with, who would be subject to Joe Biden's tax increases? The White House itself has answered, Marjorie, in the last few minutes.
Yep.
Individuals, not at $400,000, individuals making more than $453,000 would see an increase. Families making, meaning joint filers, a couple, making more than $509,000 would see an increase under the Biden plan. We're talking to Paul Revel. Marjorie, I think you should take this one because this is one of your obsessions of the last couple of weeks.
Well, you know, I've got to say, I agree with this letter writer in The Globe who says, what are these community colleges talking about when they say that they're, the four-year colleges, and I get the four-year colleges, most of them have dorms, people living there, BU, Northeastern, you know, Brown, Rutgers, et cetera, requiring
not
the kids
Harvard.
To get vaccines to come back. Not requiring vaccines to come back to school. But the community colleges, their board or whatever runs some decided, no, we're not going to have them here. I mean, really?
I find that disappointing and misguided, in my view. I think they're correct in identifying the problem that, you know, for a lot of people, the problem is access to vaccines or being persuaded that it's necessary to take vaccines and it becomes a burden. And I understand that the college presidents are worried about enrollment, not wanting to discourage any further. They've seen, you know, significant reductions in enrollment so far. So that's the problem. That's a clear problem. But the solution, I don't think, is to lower the standard, to sort of perpetuate low rates of vaccination, to create a less healthy environment on campus and in society generally. But rather, what about stepping up and saying, we're going to have a program where every student who wants to come to our college a month in advance of setting foot on campus is going to have access to a vaccine center that we set up.
Exactly.
For mobile vaccines, you know, that we give them the vaccines they need in order to be able to come on campus rather than just giving up the standard and dropping to the lowest common denominator.
You know, there are a couple of things on this. Marjorie has almost worked me into a frenzy over this. Number one, it's your idea is obviously the right one, is provide an opportunity for it there. Two, this is an area where I think the governor should speak out. This is so obviously a disincentive for vaccination, this policy. It's insane. So as someone
it speaks to a flaw in the governance system that this was just an association of presidents who made this statement. And, you know, too often the college, you know, we do have a system of community colleges, but it's a very loose system. And there's a whole bunch of autonomy in there for each campus to do its own thing, even on critical issues of public health that apply statewide here, where there ought to be state policy. This ought to be developed at the state level and promulgated by the, you know, the State Board of Higher Education. And I hope they find a way to seize that prerogative.
Great point. And
it
by the way,
like
just
the state universities in UMass are going to do it.
Right. Lane Glenn, who is the president of Northern Essex Community College, listen to the. How assured are you if you're a parent sending a student to Northern Essex Community College? Well, actually, I know a lot of them are adults. Here's what he says. It felt like a better move for our students. We anticipate a reasonably safe environment. That's a hell of an assurance to a kid or their parents. How about a totally safe environment with vaccinated students and faculty?
I'm hoping they're getting a lot of blowback, Paul. I don't know if you hear the scuttlebutt about this, but I would think that most people
I think they probably are.
Yeah.
I think this may have been a floater on their part to see whether how it would go over. And in circles I travel, it's not gone over very well. It's just not. It doesn't make sense. And it's not. It's not a move in the direction of supporting those students who they feel are burdened. I think they've got to come up with a more constructive, proactive solution to getting those students the vaccines they need to come on campus safely.
So we generally don't ask you to give advice to the guy doing the job you used to have as Secretary of Education. But so we won't call it advice
to him. Not to do that.
Okay, so let's say rather than you giving him advice, if you were still the Secretary of Education for Massachusetts, what would you do about this community college vaccination issue?
Well, I mean, the Secretary has the opportunity to advise the governor on taking a position. You already hinted at one approach, which would be to have the governor use his bully pulpit to take a position on this. Secretary is also closely in communication with the Board of Higher Education, which is appointed by the governor for the most part. And so I would use the leverage there of getting the Board of Education to the Board of Higher Education to embrace a position on this. I just stand up to it. In a way, this is sort of a rogue action by a group of the presidents acting on their own. Without consultation or seemingly without consultation with state authorities, and I think the state needs to exercise some authority here. I mean, after all, we have vaccine requirements now. I mean, this gets to the larger political conversation around vaccines that's happening nationally. But we have all kinds of vaccine requirements that we now, you know, smallpox, people have to be vaccinated, polio, things of this nature. We have these requirements, so it's not unreasonable for public authorities to demand that the public health requires that people have vaccines coming on campus and allow for, you know, religious or health exemptions. But those
no
are
more religious,
in a small
Paul.
Minority.
We're getting rid of those.
By the way, the governor in Connecticut, after we spoke to Art Kaplan yesterday, signed the end of the religious exemption into law in Connecticut.
We keep hearing about that, but there's at least according to multiple states, there's no constitutional issue here, even for Christian Scientists who could take a vaccine or other, it was a matter of conscience, or go to the dentist as a matter of conscience. So I hope that the governor gets rid of that, because I think it's a bogus one.
You know, a minute ago,
I think public opinion in a place like Massachusetts is going to favor this. How this goes around the country, I don't know. But here, I don't think there's any excuse for this kind of a lowest common denominator approach.
So a minute ago when I snidely said, when Marjorie was listing all the private four-year schools, plus UMass, then the University of California system that are mandating vaccines, I snidely said that Harvard had not, and you said under your breath, not yet. Does that mean yet will come? I mean, I don't understand why Harvard is an outlier. Why are they?
Well, just as I don't give advice to my successor, I also don't speak for Harvard. So I want to be clear on that.
Okay, but speaking for yourself, what do you think?
My understanding is the university is taking a look at this and has not yet decided on a position. My own personal opinion on it would be that the vaccines ought to be required in the same way that I prescribe that for community colleges. They're deliberating and they've got a national audience to keep in mind. And, you know, I don't know what the considerations are, but
no, I'm sure if you're a parent, you know, what's Harvard now, 75 grand a year, 80 grand a year. I'm sure you'd be thrilled to send 80 grand a year, send your kid off to be in a room and, you know, with a kid that's unvaccinated. I'm sure you'd love that.
By the way, a majority of Harvard students, undergrads, don't pay tuition. Is that not correct there, Paul?
But that's probably an overstatement. I mean, okay. I think that probably they pay some level of tuition.
It if you're may able be to get in,
majority get some form of financial aid.
Yeah, but,
yeah, if you're able to get in, then they're going to make it possible for you. I think that's the deal at Harvard. If you're smart enough to get in, they'll make sure you can pay for it. But they got to have a lot of people paying 80
grand. Which is not the same thing as saying that there are hordes of people who are getting full scholarships.
Yeah, exactly.
That's not the same.
So will you do us a favor after you speak to President Bacow about this? Can you call us back and let us know what he said?
Yeah. I'll take that suggestion under advisement as well.
Okay, take it under advisement. That's a good idea.
Paul Revels, good to talk to you as always. Thanks.
All right. Good to be with you guys. Take care.
See you later.
Paul read his op-ed, by the way, in the Boston Globe.
It's great.
It's really,
you know, it's like you get so inspired because you think it's like this is how education should be, but mm-hmm. It is kind of like turning around the Titanic in time to miss the iceberg, Jim. Unfortunately, change our public school system, isn't it?
Well, I don't know, but now's the time. By the way, Google it by typing in the word maybe Navigator and Paul Revel, and you'll find it, and it's worth a read. It really is.
Okay, Paul Revel is the former State Secretary of Education. He's a professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Redesign Lab. And his book, in which he talks about a lot of these things, it co-authored with Lynn Sachs, Collaborative Action for Equity and Opportunity, a Practical Guide for School and Community Leaders. Coming up, we're going down the rabbit hole with Cy Montgomery, and we're going to talk to her about a lot of stuff, about animals, bees, Jim's favorite subject, animal sex. We're going to talk about
too. A lot of animal sex discussion today,
and a great cat video. That's next on this edition of Afternoon Zoo. Stay tuned for Cy Montgomery on GBH Boston Public Radio.
Back to Boston Public Radio, Marge Regan and Jim Browder. Joining us on the line to lead our monthly edition of the Afternoon Zoo, which is a conversation at the intersection of animal behavior and human behavior, is Cy Montgomery. Cy is a journalist, naturalist, BPR contributor. Her latest book is Becoming a Good Creature. Hi there, Cy.
Hi, Jim. How are you?
Great
to talk
to you.
We got some great stuff today.
Yeah, you're both here. What
yes.
a treat.
Yes, we are both
we
here.
Are.
And before we get to some of your great animal stories here, this is kind of an animal story, I guess. The World Health Organization wants to end putting wild animals in food markets that are not just in China, but in other Asian countries and African nations. They're talking about, of course, the risk of spreading another horrible infectious disease like coronavirus. But you are our animal person. There's also an animal issue here. These animals that are stuck in these food markets.
Oh, it's horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been to them. I've been to these things when I was doing a book on moon bears, the Asiatic black bear. One of the ways we found animals was they were for sale at these food markets, and they would actually sell their paws. They'd take the live animal, chop off a paw, sell it to someone, have the animal sitting there bleeding. Wait. Oh, here comes another customer. Let's chop off another paw.
Oh, jeez.
I mean, the cruelty. You just can't even imagine it. It's the most disgusting thing you can imagine, and most people in China, most people in Asia, most people who go to so-called wet markets, they're buying their vegetables there. They're buying some eggs. Most people aren't going there to perpetuate some horror like this. It's a very small part of the typical market. But there's no moral reason for it to exist. And we've been warned through films and reports and books and articles and 4 out of 5 dentists. I mean, everyone has been telling us for decades that this is a fabulous way to spread horrible diseases. That 70% of the emerging diseases that afflict humans are coming from situations like this, in which animals are packed together who never would normally see each other. I mean, you normally would not have a bat who's being sold to make a crunchy bat snack, and a bear who's having his hands cut off, and a civet over here. I mean, you normally wouldn't have that, and you normally wouldn't have, you know, the bear's blood rushing into the cage with the, you know, the pangolin. It's a horrible situation, and it's just a disaster for spreading disease. So
you're with the World Health Organization to shut them down. Let's move on to something much more wonderful, or that wasn't wonderful at all, actually, obviously. Something that is wonderful. This video of this mother cat taking her kitten into a hospital, two kittens, over two separate days. Like the cat knew that the kittens were sick. The cat knew that here I am at the hospital.
I love this. And although I don't speak the language, this happened in Istanbul. Apparently, people are saying, step aside when the mother is bringing her infant in, carrying him by the scruff of the neck. They're saying, step aside, let her pass. It's just wonderful. And everyone seems to understand, as the cat understands, that she's bringing her infant in for medical help. And the thing is, this happens a lot. I mean, not necessarily kitties. This is a cat who had been getting food and water from that veterinarian office. So the mother knew about the veterinarian's office.
Still amazing.
And but the veterinarian didn't know that the mother was pregnant. But there's tons of instances in which completely wild animals come to people and ask for help. Even, you know, in Nova Scotia, a raven came who'd been quilled by a porcupine and asked someone to pull the quills out of his or her face. And a 10-foot-long manta ray swam up to somebody in Western Australia and asked a diver to pull the hooks out of their flesh. In Brazil, a humpback whale asked for 6 fishermen to help disentangle him, and then once he got disentangled, the whale stayed by the boat waving his arms, waving his pectoral fins, in thanks after they'd cut away the stuff. It's amazing to me that they know this and they know who to approach, and I'm so grateful there's people who will comply and do what the animals ask.
So I ask you the same question every time you're on. How do they know this again? I mean, how did the whale know to go to the people? How did the whatever know to get the hooks out? How did the cat know to carry its little baby into
You got to see this video, too. It's amazing.
And by the way, you can find it in a second.
They watch us. They are wonderful observers, and they have to be. Remember, you know, because no wild animal or even tame animal exists just to have congress with others of its kind. They watch everybody. And, I mean, ravens, I mean, with their eyesight, which is 40 times better than ours, there's nothing that a raven's going to miss. Same thing with manta rays and humpbacks and this mother cat and her kittens, she saw that these kind people were bringing her food and water. And she saw other people taking their animals into the door and then coming back out with their animals all fixed up. I think she figured that out pretty quickly.
It's fabulous. It's really fabulous. Check out the video, everybody. It is as great as Marjorie and Sire saying.
It is fantastic. So let's move on to the other video we watched, which wasn't such a gentle encounter. You're big into the life of the octopus. You wrote an entire book. What's the name of your book again?
Soul of an Octopus.
Soul of an Octopus. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
So you had a quite intense relationship with an octopus, but this one was a pretty angry octopus who attacked. I mean, I don't know why the octopus was
attacked.
So mad.
That's the misnomer. Well, you tell us what happened and what you think
it
was.
I agree. I don't know if this octopus was attacking. And interestingly, the octopus had been having a stare down with a seagull right before this happened. Mm-hmm. So if the octopus was upset, it might have been upset with the seagull. But what happened, the octopus did not, like, throw a spear or anything. The octopus kind of lashed out with one of its arms. Like, lashed out. I mean, the arm is boneless and covered with suckers. It's not going to do anything to you. It was like a little boy who's splashing you in the pool was kind of what was happening. And they do that sometimes to play with you. I've had octopuses squirt me in the face with their funnel sometimes when they're like, come on, let's play. Sometimes they squirt you in the face with their funnel when they're annoyed by you. It's like, get away from me. I don't even want to see you. But in this case, the octopus was accused of afterwards attacking the guy. Did you see that?
Yeah.
Yes.
After the,
yeah.
And I took a look at, there's no way. An octopus actually has venom and they have a beak. They don't have anything in their suckers akin to venom. It's not there. And I know what an octopus wound looks like. That guy, a nice guy, and I feel bad that this happened to him, and he wasn't mad at the octopus, and he's not anti-octopus, but what he had been hit with later when he went into the water 20 minutes after this octopus splashed him, and he felt something whip across his arm and then something on his back and neck. There's pictures of the wounds, and that was a jellyfish. And
yeah.
This is in Australia, and they have all kinds of really venomous jellyfish. And the guy was really smart. He was a lifeguard, and he knew that the best thing to do was pour vinegar on it.
Yes.
If there was venom, and there was no vinegar, so he poured soda over it in the shower, and the marks went away. But the marks were definitely jellyfish. I think the octopus just wanted to play.
But by the way, the octopus was on its way to the vet taking its baby octopus. So it's just, you know. But before we leave the octopus, didn't we talk to you a couple of months ago? Don't octopuses, I hope I got the right animal, don't they punch fish sometimes with their tentacles?
Sometimes they do.
Okay.
Sometimes they do, and sometimes they're doing it because the fish is their hunting partner, and their partner just screwed up. So sometimes when your partner, like, doesn't seal the deal, you might, like, give them a little punch, too, not knocking their teeth. I'm not suggesting you two fight at all.
I got it.
But, you know, sometimes you just got to make known when someone else screwed up, and that may have been the case. The fish may have been, I mean, I don't know because there wasn't long enough of a video, but they do use other species as hunting partners sometimes, and sometimes they get irritated.
So
Jim,
what's up?
Well, you want to discuss sex in the animal kingdom.
Well, there's no question that, you know, Cy Montgomery's a pretty upbeat guest. I mean, there's no question about this, but I think if you put some sort of meter on, there's no question her interest increases when we talk about sex in the animal kingdom. Is that that's a fair statement, isn't it, Cy? Obviously, nervous laughter.
It is. It's my kind of sex.
Okay, it's fine.
Absolutely.
Excuse me. Now, let's start with it's a special feature, Sex in the Animal Kingdom. We're going to talk about gorillas, and apparently, after reading what we did this morning, size does matter. Is that correct, or is that not correct?
That's good for you, Jim.
Well, how do you know?
You're 6'5".
Oh, thank you. I'm sorry. So explain this story to us, if you would, please.
Well, this was just reported by researchers with the Diane Fossey Gorilla Fund up in the Virunga Volcanoes in Rwanda, where I have been and where I have met the gorillas and where I have heard the phenomenon that they're talking about. Gorillas, as many people know, well, when they want to capture the attention of a female or intimidate a rival, they stand up on their hind legs and they beat their chest.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes this wild pocking sound, a pocking sound like there's something hollow that they're beating on, which there is. They have these holes, you know, like air pockets in their chests that creates this sound, which will carry for a kilometer, even in dense forest. And it turns out that they have discovered that the larger males make deeper pocking sounds with lower frequencies, which actually reflects the size of their body. And body size determines rank and fighting ability and reproductive success amongst the male silverback gorillas. And so they are giving a signal, and they're not lying. It's really true. It's not like the short little guy who drives up to pick up his date in the cool sports car, which he borrowed from his friend. They are advertising something real. This is really the biggest, toughest, strongest mountain gorilla.
Okay, so what we're going to do, we're going to test your theory here. Mm-hmm. We're going to play some sound of a male silverback gorilla beating its chest. And we want you, Cy Montgomery, to say whether you find this particular gorilla appealing or not. Here is the silverback beating its chest. Go ahead. That's exactly like you said it was going to sound, by the way. So what do you make of that, Cy Montgomery?
Oh, be still my heart.
By the way, that is not at all what I expected the sound to be.
No,
was it for you,
me
Marjorie?
Neither. No, I mean, I thought there'd be a little bit more vocalization there along with it. But,
well, sort of like those air pockets. It sounds like it's they're tapping
like
on
pockets.
The air pockets, like you said, right,
Si? That's exactly it. That's exactly it. It's so interesting. And they do have voices. I mean, and they can roar if they want to. But why do that if you can pock your chest and have that travel for a kilometer?
Is that true? Travel
for
a kilometer?
Yeah, for a kilometer, it says.
Yes, and that's in really dense forest. This is in a cloud forest that's, you know, draped with all kinds of moss that would dampen sound.
Wow.
So to travel a kilometer in that kind of situation, it's a very loud, impressive sound. And you can hear it far away. Before you see the gorilla, sometimes you can hear that. Wow. And you know, oh boy, there's a gorilla near me.
Talking to Cy Montgomery.
So that was the male gorilla, but apparently are some male birds, as this headline in the New York Times says, flying under false colors to attract the girl birds?
What is this, a riot? I think this is so interesting. Mostly, the reason this is so interesting, mostly bright red male birds are advertising, hey, look at my bright red color. This means I have high levels of these pigments called carotenoids in their feathers. Mm-hmm. And that reflects like, oh, I've had excellent nutrition and my metabolism is using this excellent nutrition. And so I am your best bet to father lots of healthy little nestlings. But in some birds, like tanagers, the brightest red and orange males create that red in a different way, not through the pigments on their feathers, but through these light reflecting structures in the feathers that don't correlate with better health.
Wow.
Yeah, I think that's so fascinating. But the thing is, they may be advertising not like, oh, your nestlings are going to be healthy if they get my genes, but they could be correctly advertising your male offspring will inherit my cool feathers, and they will be able to have lots of grandchildren for you. So in that way, it may not be a lie.
By the way, that is like the little guy who drives his friend's sports car, is it not? I hate
that. Right.
I mean,
right.
That is
like,
really.
Hey, I may not be the toughest guy in the world, but I figured out a way to have a pretty cool sports car.
You know, I was telling Jim, I was at a friend of mine, Sally's house, a couple of weeks ago, and she has a lot of land in the back of her house. And we saw all these turkeys, and I see turkeys all the time around my neighborhood in Brookline, but I've never seen them. There were like five or six of them with all their tails and their beautiful plumage splayed. I guess it's mating season, and they strutting around in this pack. I didn't see any female turkeys, you know, much to, I guess, the male chagrin. But so I don't see that here, but I saw it there. So what's that about?
Oh, yeah, they're definitely, sometimes they're showing off to other males, but they'd rather be showing off to females.
Yeah.
And once my car was hit, and I knew exactly why this guy hit me. He was a turkey hunter, and he'd been watching the turkey that I had just seen a little while ago coming the other way, who was displaying, and he wasn't watching the road, he was watching the turkey. There's tons of people around here that just stop in the middle of the road to see stuff.
Yes.
But right now they're out there and they're puffed up and they have this fabulous stance and they fan their tail and they show it from this angle and then they turn and they show it from this angle and they have the bright red face and the blue nude thing coming down, and boy, you really, it's a great show if you're a hen turkey right now.
Well, sadly, this is the end of our Sex in the Animal Kingdom segment for this
particular
month.
We're trying to do it every time we talk about it.
We're going
to
do it every
month. But we can add salamanders. That's all about sex.
Wait, what are salamanders doing?
They're having Congress.
What is that?
Which you wish was their Congress. Yeah, this is what I spent last night doing. There's these giant salamanders. They're like, they can grow 9 inches long. They come out like once a year. Yeah. And only if it's 44 degrees or warmer, and it's raining, it's at night. And they come out of their holes where they spend their whole year, and they migrate to these vernal pools, and they have wild sex. And it's fantastic. You look into the pool where this is happening, and at first you think, I see nothing but the stars reflected in the water. Mm. But what you're seeing is this Escher drawing of live 9-inch black salamanders covered with these gorgeous yellow spots. And they are just wiggling all over each other. And the males are butting other males and whacking them with their tails and trying to get close to the females. And you're only going to see it on nights like last night and tonight when they're crossing, usually from to a vernal pool, which is a short-term pool. In fact, I sent some pictures, which you should look at. I said to Chelsea of what some of the salamanders we found last night. So you too can enjoy watching others enjoy themselves.
Do you have any video of this or no? Sorry.
What's that?
Is there any video of the salamanders doing it?
Oh, I'm sure there is. I'm sure there is.
Okay.
Yeah. But, so, I mean, you don't think that we have a 9-inch black salamander that's, like, living right among us, but we do.
But wait a second. And this is literally just once a year, one day? Or are you exaggerating?
It's once a year, and it only happens on nights when it's 44 degrees or more and raining. So far, the only night that, you know, hasn't been the middle of the night, I don't know what they're doing in the middle of the night, but I've been waiting and waiting all spring for this. And the first night that I could go out and find, last night was the big night. And lots of people were out with our nature center, the Harris Center. We helped them cross. We helped them cross the roads. These animals live like, they can live up to 30 years, these salamanders.
Wow.
And they're big animals. And so if you help them cross the road, they could go live, you know, for more decades. It's a big deal. But a lot of them, because they're just a salamander and they're black on the black tarmac, people don't see them. They don't mean to run them over. So we're out there with our reflective vests and our big sign, Salamander Crossing, telling people to slow down and trying to get them off, get the salamanders off the road.
By the way, you know, sending those videos is illegal in 17 states for whatever it's worth. One of our colleagues just sent us...
Only if they're underage salamanders.
Exactly. Sent us the photograph of a spotted salamander, which is great. And if you want to check them out yourself, they're referred to formally as spring lizards. And you can see these beautiful yellow-spotted salamanders. You know, before you go, Cy Montgomery, we're going to talk to our listeners about something. I think we spoke to you briefly about a month or so ago, and is becoming a bigger issue as the pandemic hopefully winds down. We know that more people got pets than practically ever before, which is a wonderful thing. That's the good news. And the other piece of good news, they got to spend a huge amount of time with their new pet. The bad news is a lot of those people are going back to work, and there apparently is huge both pet owner and pet anxiety. And do you have a minute to give us and those people some advice about how to, I don't know if ensure, but at least mitigate the pain, forget the human, that the animal is going to feel when the human starts going back to work?
Yes. If you're going to go back to work and you have a little notice, try to do it gradually.
Yeah.
Because for all of us, it's really hard to just suddenly go, you know, from being with the person that you love the most to, like, never seeing them all day. So try to do it slowly. And the other thing is try to have something for your pet to do. It's boring. So have someone come over and visit. Or there's all kinds of, like, weird toys you can get that will just randomly throw, like, a treat at your dog every 20 minutes. Try to come home for your lunch break at first. I mean, everyone takes time getting used to stuff.
Yeah.
You know, Cy, can I ask you two quick follow-up questions to this? We only have a minute. When you leave, if you want to have your let's say dog for starters, start anticipating that you're going to leave for periods of time. If you leave for a minute to give them an experience, do they know that you only left for a minute as opposed to left for 4 hours or no?
Yes, they do.
Okay.
The way they tell time is the way odors decay. That's what we think.
Wow.
So one thing that's helpful if you're going to leave is leave them with a piece of your clothing that smells like you.
Okay.
And often that will help.
And second question, just confirm for me, a lot of cat owners think that cats are fine being alone. And what I've read in the last day or two, they're fine if they're used to being alone. But if your cat has had you around 24/7 or close to it as well, you have to worry about how they're going to adapt to your departure as well. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is true for your cat. This is true for your birds. Even the penguins at the zoo miss having people come to visit them, like we talked about last week.
Yes,
oh, that's
we did.
Are used to, they get used to a situation, and they enjoy being with us like we enjoy being with them.
Wow. Hey, Cy, as
Thank
always.
Thank you great. So much.
Thank you.
That was great.
Great talking with you.
Thanks, Cy Montgomery, again. Cy Montgomery is a journalist, naturalist, and BPR contributor. Her latest book is Becoming a Good Creature. I think you'd really enjoy it. She joins us every month. And thank you again. Coming
By the way, we should go up next year to New Hampshire with her for Salamander Night. I mean, whenever
should.
That is, that
that's a great
would be
idea.
Quite an experience, it sounds
that's
like.
That's a great idea. You have to make sure it's raining and above 44
degrees. 44 degrees,
degrees
correct,
and,
yes.
You know, I know you're very interested in animal sex, so we'll do whatever we can to accommodate
so I
you,
is, Jim. I am. That's exactly correct.
Coming up, we are asking you what we just talked about with Cy. If going back to work means major separation anxiety for your pet, and for you. We're opening up the lines at 877-301-8970, bpr@wgbh.org. Are you worried about leaving your pet when you go back to work? That's next on 89.7 GBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. The pandemic has also created what people are calling a pet-demic. It's what we talked to Cy about a minute ago. With so many of us doing everything from home, spending so much more time with our animals, many of which are new to us, we become their emotional support humans. There's also been a huge spike in pet adoptions. You know this, and a lot of anxieties about what comes next for these creatures now that we're returning to work. And we're nervous, too. We're taking your calls asking, what is your work-from-work plan when it comes to managing your pet separation anxiety? Is it time for the workplace to offer on-site pet care? I don't think so. Who is going to experience the most separation anxiety, you or your pet? And what do you think of the advice from Cy Montgomery? And if you have better ideas or additional ideas about what to do to make it easier, both for your pet and for the human being side of the relationship, please give us a call. We don't have a hell of a lot of time, so call soon, 877-301-8970. And if you don't have answers, you're just anxious about it, we'll try to help in whatever way we can. 877-301-8970.
Cy, being the expert that she is, says exactly what some of these experts in these stories are saying, and the things I used to hear when I had my own dog, Harry the Peanut, who was no longer with us, and I was very worried about leaving him to go to work all the time. You know, one of the things that I think is makes so much sense, you have to slowly work up to it. If you've been home all the time, you don't want to suddenly leave your dog for 8 hours, but you want to leave for an hour, you want to leave for 2 hours, give the dog something to do. You know, if you can afford it, you can get a dog walker in there maybe a couple of times a week so the dog will have something to break up the day. And the big thing is, that I read in these stories and that I was told too, is don't make it a big deal. I used to always give my dog a treat of peanut butter on a stick or peanut butter on something or peanut butter on one of those little toys. We have to keep finding the peanut butter in there.
I love those.
So that was a signal. Here's the peanut butter. I'm leaving. I'll be back. And you know what somebody else told me too? You know, if you've not crated your dog because...
Don't start now.
But if you leave the dog in like one bedroom as opposed to having the dog have the run of your whole apartment or your whole house, because then they feel like they've got to run around guarding everything, that if they're in one place, smaller place, that it's better for them. But I've not heard that from a vet. I just heard that from people advising me.
So your number, the number is 877-301-8970. How are you dealing with your own anxiety if you have to start separating from your pet with whom you've spent a lot more time than you probably ever would have or ever had? And are you worried about how your pet's going to react? I mean, you should be worried about how your pet's going to react. And what are you planning on doing about it? By the way, this is a good idea. Mackenzie, our coworker, just typed us a note. My mom was a pet sitter, her mom, not mine, had a lot of clients who would leave the TV on for their pets.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't get lonely. That's actually a great and pretty simple idea, too. 877-301.
Or Jim.
8970. What?
They could leave the radio on and listen to Boston Public Radio.
They could.
And they could listen to us when we talk about pet sex with Simon Montgomery.
They could. Or, by the way, as you know, I have recorded and played thousands of times every episode of Greater Boston. If people want a Blu-ray of that that they can play for their pets on a loop, I'd be happy to oblige. 877-301-8970. By the way, you know, we're making light of this. It's really,
are you kidding?
It is really hard
wreck.
For both ends of the relationship. It's
absolutely.
Really, really hard. And by the way, the great thing is many more pets, as I said, everyone knows this, have been adopted during the pandemic. And hopefully, as much as people needed them during the pandemic, they're going to be sensitive to their needs as the pandemic winds down and we start to return to the semi-real world.
Of course, doggy daycare, but that's not cheap.
It's also not cheap either.
It's not cheap, but especially the younger dogs, I really love that. And I've seen those dog little vans where they come and they pick up the dog at your house and take the dog off to doggy daycare to spend the day there. 877-301-8970 is the number. BPR@WGBH.org is the email. Margo in New Hampshire, what do you think, Margo?
Hey, Margo.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
So I just want to like name drop for a second. I actually walked with Cy this morning.
Oh,
you did?
The dog Thurber. Yes, I live in New Hampshire in the same town. So
we love her, by the way. Everybody loves this woman. She is just brilliant.
Yes.
Yeah.
Everybody loves Cy. So, but we're pretty simpatico on the animals come first, and I've basically reconfigured my entire life after being home for this past year so that I can work and not leave the dog. I have an older dog and I was really attached to him anyway. And I was struggling with my last job being out of the home for 9 and 10 hours a day. It was really awful. And so after being home, I just, I made a choice and I've taken a job that's really working for us. Where I don't have to leave for more than an hour or two at a time.
Wow. Yeah, that is unbelievable.
You are really devoted.
I mean, it is. But, Margo, before you go...
I feel lucky.
Yeah.
I can tell you do. How did your dog, when you were working 9 or 10 hours a day, what'd you do with your dog for that period of time?
It was really stressful. He just stayed home. He's a little bit older. He's 11.
Oh,
and
I see.
But he was obviously really bored and very kind of clingy and needy when I was home. So I just made sure he got lots of walks as much as possible, and he doesn't socialize well. So I couldn't have people drop in necessarily.
Yeah.
So, it was hard. And the weekends were really, I was very, very conscious on the weekends of being with him as much
Understood.
As possible.
I'll tell you, Margo, your pet is lucky to have you. Margo, thanks very much for your call. Say hi to Cy when you see her on the next walk.
You know, that is one of the things I think you don't appreciate till you get a dog. Dogs are pretty needy.
Oh, yeah.
And if you can't be home a lot and you want to be, if you're going to go to work all day, then you're going to go out at night. I mean, don't get a dog because it's not going to work well. Or if you're going to be gone, you got to be kind of a home person or have somebody there to have a dog because they don't do well by themselves.
You know, by the way, this reminds me of one of my least favorite stories. A very high-profile radio host.
Horrible
story. A very high-profile radio host who almost all of you know, and if I'm in the right mood, I may say who it is in a minute. When Marjorie brought the great Harry the P to work at our old radio station one day because we had no choice, she reported Marjorie to the damn boss. Without even telling Marjorie, she just called the boss.
She called the boss.
And you hear this woman on the radio almost every day, by the way. So if you want to know who she is, send me an email.
Okay. But you know something? We had another very famous radio host who's now retired who used to bring his dog to work there all the time.
Yeah, I know.
Remember?
Yeah, I do.
I don't know why.
Their ratings were higher than ours. That's, I think, I think that's the answer. He's retired. He was a pretty great guy, by the way.
He was a great guy. Unlike he had a great dog, too. Total and my jerk. Dog was like 10 pounds.
Rin in Whitman. I hope I got your name right. Hi, Rin. Welcome.
Oh, hi. It's actually Lynn.
Oh, Lynn. Sorry. I'm so sorry. My fault.
That's okay.
Lynn, we're glad that's to have okay. you. Hi.
Hello. Hi. So my husband and I own a doggy daycare. So, and I listen every day, first time caller.
Thank you.
And I thought, you know what? This one I'm going to call in for because great. I can totally weigh in. So we actually have a doggy school bus. It's yellow, small little doggy school bus. And my husband is the doggy school. We laugh because he has his master's degree and he drives a school bus and picks up poop for a living now. But we're much happier than we used to be 20-something years ago when we were both in corporate America.
Great. So what's the name, of your dog daycare operation?
Oh, sure. Thank you. It's Furry Tails Pet Care in Abington. Mm-hmm. And we are very, very busy with our doggy daycare. We're a kennel and a grooming shop, too. So you can imagine our kennel was not very busy the past year. People were not traveling. But our daycare is thriving because of... everybody adopted a puppy, and then what happened was they were home with the puppies trying to do Zoom work, and puppies were jumping up and on the table and yeah. pawing at them for attention. So they were sending their dogs to us even during the pandemic, even when they were home, because they couldn't get a darn thing done between their children and their dogs. Something had to give, and they could actually send them to the doggy daycare. So my husband drives the yellow school bus around and goes into the home, picks the dogs up, brings them onto the bus, and then brings them to the daycare for the day.
Well, you know, one of the great things about doggy daycare, because I used to do doggy daycare with my dog, was the socialization aspect. Oh, yeah. You know, they really get there. They're there all day long with a bunch of other dogs. And when they're puppies, at least my dog couldn't wait to get to doggy daycare every day. He had a blast. Come home exhausted.
You know. Hey, Lynn, you're the wrong person to ask, but since you're there, is it affordable at your place or no? I mean, the issue is everybody'd love to send their dog to doggy daycare. Is it affordable?
I think it's affordable. We are $20 for the day, and then $5 each ride. You know, if you need a pickup on one end, it's $5. If you need a pickup on the other, some people don't do it every day because, of course, that is not affordable. Mm-hmm. But if you need it twice a week, and your dog comes home and is tired for the next day and a half, then yeah. it's pretty, you know, I think it's pretty reasonable because your dog won't just be tired that night. It will carry into the next day. Some people will call us back up and say, I think there's something wrong with my dog. He's not having dinner. And I'll say, no, that's your dog socializing for 6 hours and that's 8 hours and then taking a ride on a school bus. They're tired.
Yeah.
Hey, Lynn, thanks for listening. And we're glad you finally called, and say hi to your husband, the bus driver, too. We appreciate it.
They get their little daycare friends, too, which is pretty exciting.
By the way, if you can, you know, what Lynn said, I think it was a really important point. I mean, virtually nobody can afford it every day. But if you can afford it every once in a while, I'm with you. My experience with my two kids' dogs.
That's right.
For whom I've had responsibility daycare. For the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Even one day every couple of weeks, the excitement level when they get there is like out of control, and they get to spend the whole day with other animals and whatever. So
did you say you got the two dogs now?
No. I said when they occasionally drop one of them or even both of them off for a weekend or something. And I mean, that's one of the great things, by the way, just having them for a limited period of time. It's fabulous.
That's right. It's like the grandchildren.
And then I call Lynn's husband and he cleans up after them. It's fabulous. It's incredible.
Remember we used to have a dog walker that called us? Who would be out with 6 or 8 dogs walking around.
She calls us quite regularly from the central part of Massachusetts. Big fan of the radio show. Laura
from
Rhode
Island.
Hi.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
We can.
Oh, my God. I can't believe I'm on the phone with you. I love you guys so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And I've been listening to you forever, but I had to call today because I thought, Jim, that you would get a kick out of this. My husband went away on work to Paris, and while he was gone, instead of getting the one dog, I got two dogs because I didn't want one of them to be too lonely.
That's great.
And still, my little boy dog is pretty anxious. And so he has not learned how to not pee in the house. So he is in diapers 24 hours a day in the house.
Oh, gosh.
Diapers on a dog?
Yes.
And doesn't the dog rip off the diapers, Laura?
He does not. He does not rip off the diaper. I don't know why.
Probably can't reach it with his mouth.
So, Laura, yeah, I think the big question is not the diaper. Did your husband ever come home from Paris?
He did, and he's just never forgiven me.
That's what I figured. Look what I got. Two dogs.
Well, you can get little doggy Prozac, Laura. I mean, I don't have a lot of dogs on Prozac.
I gave my cat Prozac years ago, and it worked wonders.
There you go.
You know, Laura, on a serious note, what some, we didn't mention this with Cy, but some people say one of the ways to deal with the loneliness that a pet might feel as people are returning to work is if you can afford it and have the time, get a second pet so the pet has company. Hey, Laura, we're really glad you called. Really glad you got through. Stay in touch with us. And thank you for being here. We appreciate it.
Okay, and thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow we're going to be joined by CNN's John King, House Ways and Means Chairman Richie Neal.
Oh, great.
And media maven Sue O'Connell. We want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Zoe Matthews, Hannah Ubeley, Aidan Conley, Mackenzie Farkas, our engineer, John McClaw Parker, and Miles Smith and Dave Goldstein, who run our remote studios. What's on your television show tonight, Jim?
Before I say what's on the television show, I just checked the ratings for this show. They spiked during the Sex and the Animal Kingdom. I can't even say it. It's so exciting.
Well, your favorite animal sex is dung beetles. Is that not correct,
Dung
Jim?
Beetles in a movie, I'll say it for the 4,000th time, called Metamorphosis.
Don't
and
miss
it's,
it.
It's
Think
about
of Jim.
Tiny. Oh, no, it's Microcosmos. It's not
Microcosmos.
Microcosmos. I'm so sorry. I'm misleading people. Tonight is a best of, and actually we have great guests, great discussions, and I would watch it if I were you. So please do. That's at 7 o'clock. I am Jim Browdy.
And I am Marjorie Egan. Thanks again for tuning in. Once again, CNN's John King, Richie Neal, who's the most, we're supposed to say, the very powerful chair of the House of
Representatives. He's the money guy in the House of Representatives. And by the way, last time he was on, this is what one of the things we're talking about tomorrow, he was honest enough to admit that this one-year child credit that is going to reduce poverty, child poverty, by 50%, their goal was, he admitted it, to get their foot in the door and to make it permanent. So we're going to talk to him about what kind of progress they're making on that incredibly important front in the House of Representatives. So that's tomorrow.
Okay. Once again, I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thanks again for tuning in. I hope you can tune in tomorrow. And it's kind of a rainy day, but what the heck. I hope you have a great one anyway. See you later.
Bye.